The Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan podcast by night, all day.
All right, with me today, this Friday night, you can catch him live on Spike TV, Glory 19, right? It's number 19?
Yes, sir.
Stitch him up, Joe Schilling, live from Los Angeles. Welcome aboard, brother. Pull that sucker right up to your face.
All
right. Don't be shy. You're drinking distilled water, huh? That's to cut weight? Is that what that is?
Yes, sir.
How much you cut?
I try to cut like 12 pounds of water, maybe a little less, but the process. It's like 5 gallons of water over 3 days.
Is there like a science to this, or is this like, does everybody do the same thing? Or like, it seems like a lot of people have different methods on how to do this.
Yeah, a lot of people have different methods. I read about it online probably 5 years ago from some wrestler, and we tried it and it worked really well for me. So I just keep the same way, but I'll do 2 gallons of water. Like my weigh-in's on Thursday, so I started on Sunday. 2 gallons of distilled water on Sunday. 2 gallons on Sunday, 2 gallons on Monday, 1 gallon Tuesday to Wednesday, and then Wednesday for 24 hours, I won't drink any water, no salt, and just kind of comes right off.
So Wednesday, no water, all the way through Thursday, no water. The weigh-ins are Thursday?
Yeah.
And because of the distilled water, because the distilled water has no minerals in it, it's mm-hmm. just pure water, it just flushes through your system? Is that the idea behind it?
Yeah, and it doesn't have any minerals, so your body doesn't hold on to it. And because it's flushing through your system, it pulls all the other minerals out with it. So, you know, the first 2 days, you're just peeing like crazy. You're sweating like crazy. You put on deodorant, you're still sweating like crazy. Your body feels like it's over flooded with water. And that last 24-hour period, it's still in that same cycle. And you're, you know, the rest of the water just comes right out.
Yeah, see, I would think that that would be not good for you.
Yeah, it's probably not.
Distilled water? Yeah. It just seems like, because I know my friend Aubrey, he went on this weird diet of distilled water. Like, he thought, like, distilled water would be pure. And he started getting dizzy and shit, I think. And he went and got himself checked out. And they're like, dude, you don't have any fucking minerals in your system.
Yeah.
Like, you can't be doing that. Like,
yeah, it's definitely not a healthy thing. It's not a, you know, I definitely don't advocate it for anything other than cutting weight.
But, what do you weigh in at?
187.
You weigh in at 187. You walk around somewhere around?
If I'm walking around, like, maybe 6 weeks ago, I was probably like 210, 212. You know, if that's eating whatever I want, you know, drinking beer, doing whatever I want to do.
Yeah, everybody's got their own little ideas about what should be done as far as, like, how much weight to cut before you compete. Mm-hmm. Some guys think cut the minimum amount possible, and then there's these extreme dudes that cut, like, 30, 40 pounds.
Yeah, it really comes down to everybody, and then also, like, your style of fighting. Some guys, I think, need to feel strong, a lot bigger and stronger because maybe they're lacking or because they, you know, whatever reason they need to be bigger and stronger than the other guy. But there's a hindrance, you know. I've cut too much weight and overhydrated and learned lessons that way where you're, you know, I think when I fought Simon Marcus the second time, when I flew to Vegas, I still had like 1 gallon of distilled water I was supposed to drink, and they wouldn't let me take it on the plane, giant gallon of water. And as soon as I landed, they had me doing press and stuff, and I didn't get to drink that last gallon of water. So I started drinking coffee like crazy, thinking, well, that's diuretic. It'll help me lose the water. And when that 24-hour period came where it was time to cut the weight, I hadn't really dropped anything. I was still like 22 pounds over. So I had to cut 22 pounds in 24 hours. And
whoa.
It was terrible. It was awful.
And then,
you know, the first round, I came out strong. I felt really good. And then after the second round, it was like, it was almost like, you know, when you have a dream and you're trying to fight somebody, but you're laying on your arm and you can't get the
right
punch off. It was just like that. And yeah, it was a bad performance. So I learned from that one a lot.
The point of diminishing returns. That's a big one when it comes to weight cutting, right? It's almost like a whole nother event in itself.
Mm-hmm.
There's like the fight, the training for the fight, the preparation, skill, strength and conditioning, all that jazz. And then there's this weight cutting thing that's a totally different event. And mm-hmm. guys fail at it. Like this past weekend, 2 big important fights, the guys failed at it. John Lineker failed for like the 5th fucking time. The guy can't make 125, but he wants to be the bigger guy.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't want to fight 135. And then Kelvin Gastelum, same thing. Couldn't make 170 for like the 4th time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, I don't know how many times Kelvin's missed. Not as many as Lineker, but he's, you know, he's gotten it close many times.
And then you got a guy like Anthony Johnson that was like really had a really bad reputation in the UFC. He got cut because he couldn't make weight, and then finally decided to stick to his natural weight, and he's killing it, you know. So it's
ridiculous.
It's a weird balancing act. I think everybody has their own, you know, you got to learn your lessons and work from it.
There's never been a guy like Johnson who, like, at 170, you know, he's a good fighter, very good, but struggles to make weight and then fades late in fights because he's depleting the shit out of his body. Mm-hmm. Goes all the way up to heavyweight and beats the shit out of Andre Arlovsky. And you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Heavyweight? And then drops down to 205 to compete in the UFC, makes weight, no problem, and is the number one contender now.
And just terrifying. Terrifying fighter. Amazing. You know?
It's amazing how this guy, like, not torturing his body, is now one of the best fighters on earth. Whereas 3 years ago, he didn't have a career. His career was fucked up.
Right.
All just because of weight cutting.
Yeah, you know, it's a weird thing, you know. If you don't do the weight cutting, and you, or we did like same day weigh-ins, then you still have guys that are going to try to cut the weight and fight the same day, and it's not healthy, you know.
It's terrible, boy, especially striking sports. It's terrible for you with wrestling, but guys get away with it. But with combat sports, anytime you're involving head strikes, you really don't have enough time to replenish all the water that protects your brain, all the water in your head. And that was one of the issues that people used to have back in the old days, where they used to weigh in and fight on the same day. They changed that around the Darko Kim fight, I believe. It's also when they dropped it from 15 rounds to 12 in boxing, because they just felt like 15 is too long.
And they changed the gloves. Heavyweights used to wear 8-ounce gloves.
Wow. Yeah.
And then now it's, I think you have to be under 145 to be an 8-ounce gloves.
Wow.
I mean, can you imagine heavyweight fighting with 8-ounce gloves? It's basically an MMA glove, just a different style, you know.
Wow. Well, how about the Jack Johnson days where they used to wear those Everlast bag gloves?
Right.
Those little they were just basically knuckle pads.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Well, there's some guys that think, and I'm one of them, that MMA would probably be more realistic and better if no one wore gloves. I feel like if you can knee someone in the face, elbow someone in the face, kick someone in the face, why you punched him in the face with gloves on, it just protects your hands more than anything. And also the wrists, like having your wrist taped up and nice and solid, like it makes it so that you can hit people harder.
Right.
You could be much more careless with your punches. Like if you had bare knuckles, it would be a much more realistic like scenario as far as like what you can do with your body.
Right.
You're taping everything up and wrapping everything nice and tight and solid and padding it. You know, you're turning your hand to a different thing.
Right. Well, it's like some athletic commissions allow you to tape your ankle. Some athletic commissions don't. You know, if you watch like the OK-1s and stuff, you'll see like Badr Hari and these guys have like a huge amount of padding placed over their ankle and their foot.
Yeah.
That padding is not protecting the person they're hitting. It's protecting you. So if you're ripping kicks and you kick somebody in the elbow, you know, and you have a pad on it, it's going to protect you. You're going to be more likely to keep kicking than if you smashed your foot in the first one. So
it's kind of
interesting.
Yeah, I think protect your tees, protect your balls. That's it. I think maybe that's the best way to go. But everybody has this thing where it would look more barbaric if somehow or another your knuckles weren't protected.
Right. Well, then also you got to look at it from like a promotion standpoint. You know, if everybody was breaking their hands in fights, you know, as a fan, we wouldn't get to see those fights, you know, as often as we like to see them, you know, so.
That is true, but.
And then you talk about, like, the impact on and the problems with brain damage and, you know, the side effects for guys after their career. Can you imagine if we had even less padding on our hands and, you know, it's.
Well, they think that there would be actually less brain damage because guys wouldn't get hit as much. You'd have to be much more judicious with where you placed your punches. And, you know, because of the fact that you know, if you hit somebody in the forehead, you're most likely going to snap your knuckles.
Right.
You'd be a little bit more careful. I don't know. It's a weird argument.
Yeah.
It's like the same argument with football. They've said that if football players didn't have pads, didn't have helmets, it would be a safer game for the players. But, of course, in football, they're not punching each other in the face.
Yeah, and there's always going to be that one guy that, like, just like the one guy that did same day weigh-ins, there's always gonna be that one guy that thinks he can still cut 30 pounds and fight the day of,
yep.
And dies, or
yeah,
the one guy that doesn't care and keeps hitting the person when his hand's broken. You know, it's a
yeah, you know, that's true. That's true. So you were in camp with Nick Diaz in preparation for his fight this past weekend with Anderson Silva, which was an amazing fight. You know, and I've been thinking a lot about that fight after it was over. And one of the things that really, really like locked into my head was. There's a lot of people that are calling for Anderson to retire now, you know, and they're saying that, you know, and even Chris Weidman's one of them. He said he'd like to see Anderson retire. Mm. But I watched the fight, and I was thinking about myself after the fight. Like, Nick and Silva, that was a better fight than Nick and Carlos Condit. Mm-hmm. It was a better fight than GSP and Nick. Like, these are it was a good fight.
Right.
It was a good, competitive, exciting fight. And, you know, Anderson Silva fighting Nick Diaz. Nick Diaz is a tough motherfucker. He's a good fighter. He's very smart and very crafty. And I think that, you know, like, the guy coming off of those two fights, it's almost like just we expect more of him than of just a regular fighter. Like, like, if that was GSP in his prime and he put on the exact same performance, and if you just, you know, CGI GSP's body and made someone watch the fight, well, that's a good fight. Right. Well, the beginning was kind of ridiculous. Nick was clowning him, which was hilarious.
Hilarious, you know.
I was howling laughing. I couldn't stop myself. I was slapping the table when he laid down and put his head like taking a nap.
We were in the corner laughing. We couldn't believe it. You know, I was worried about him. You know, going into the fight, I felt a lot of responsibility for him, kickboxing wise. You know,
right?
I mean? And I felt like my job helping him out. You know, he's one of my good friends. I trained with him anyway. But in this fight at camp, I was kind of more of a coaching and. I felt a lot of responsibility, you know, not to get caught. You know, did I teach him the right things? Did I tell him enough stuff? I felt like a lot of responsibility. And, you know, I'm yelling out instructions or whatever, and he did that, and I was like, you know, and then he stood up and walked right at him with his hands down. I'm like, oh, don't get fucking hit.
Right.
But, yeah, I was super proud of him. Yeah, that's happened to me in the past, too, with, you know, when I fought Cal Cly, nobody thought I was going to win. I was, Joe's going to get destroyed, you know, and I was the only one that believed I was going to win. And then once I beat him decisively, then it was, oh, he should retire. He's not good anymore. And I think that's just not fair, you know. It's like the guy comes back from, two losses, and one of them was a horrific, you know, shin break. And then Nick Diaz does what, you know, before the fight, everyone thought Nick wasn't going to go more than one round, you know. He was going to get murdered by the GOAT, you know. And then Nick puts on a great performance. Anderson... You know, Nick's hard to fight. Nick's hard to finish, you know. But then all of a sudden, it's all, he's not the same guy. He should retire. I just think that's not fair for Anderson or for Nick, you know.
Yeah, I agree. I think Anderson did better than Carlos Condit did. He did better than George St. Pierre did. George essentially fought him a little bit on the feet, but most of the fight he took him down, you know, and tried to take him down and control him on the ground. And George is a very strong guy. He's got real good top control. But, you know, Anderson stood up with him, and the entire fight was taking place kickboxing. And I think Anderson looked good, you know, and especially when you come off two big losses like that and your head's all fucked up, man. And, you know, everybody's calling on you to retire. First of all, the first fight had to fuck with his confidence so hard that he did that because he was clowning and he got caught, which is everyone's worst nightmare. Mm-hmm. Because, like, when you're clowning, you're trying to make fun of your opponent, and then, boom, you get cracked with a big left hook, and the lights go out, and you're like, no way. That way? Like, to lose that way after all those victories, after the Vitor Belfort fight, after fucking up Chael Sonnen in the rematch, and after all those spectacular victories against James Irvin and Forrest Griffin, and, you know, to lose like that is like, holy shit.
Yeah. I mean, that was... Going into the camp, I was looking at stuff because, you know, it was a really tough fight for Nick. And, you know, a lot of people didn't think he was going to, you know, Forrest Griffin, when the fight first came out, said that, you know, it was just a silly fight. I wouldn't call it a super fight. You know, he's just too small for that, you know. And I think a lot of people counted him out. But when I was looking at Anderson's fights, things that I noticed were people say he was showboating or whatever. I think that when it didn't go his way against Chris Weidman the first time, he kind of broke mentally, and that's why he started showboating. And I had done that in the past and paid for it. But ultimately, I think that his style is to bait people into coming so he can use his reach and then catching them with shots. So with Nick, you know, my thing was you have to find that middle range somehow, you know, either get him to come at you or go just enough that you're inside of that middle range, but not go all the way into the clinch and get stuck in his clinch, you know.
Right.
And that was, I think, I had a lot to do with Nick baiting him to come forward. And I think that also messed with Anderson's head. No one's ever clowned Anderson, you know. A lot of these guys go in there and they, I think they get surprised by, they're just not prepared to fight that level of kickboxing. You know, they're not used to seeing that level of striking, that speed, that range, those moves. And then the other thing is that they get out there and they're like, I'm fighting, you know, the best striker in the world. This is the GOAT.
Right.
And I think that was a big thing for Nick was, you know, I don't think Nick believes for a second that he's the greatest fighter of all time. You know what I mean?
Right.
And same thing with Chael Sonnen the first time he fought him. Chael fought, you know, for all the stuff that Chael said, Chael really believed he was going to beat Anderson Silva that night, which is why he did beat him for, you know, almost the entire fight until he got caught. I think the second fight maybe was a little different. But I think most of the other guys that he fought didn't really think that they could – they didn't visualize themselves winning that fight, and then that gave it to Anderson.
Well, Anderson is a great counter striker, and that's always been what he's most spectacular at. I mean, he will lead, but most of the time he only does it when he has a massive advantage, like the first couple rounds against Damian Maia. Like, he was going after Maia.
Mm-hmm.
But Damian Maia is like a plodding guy who doesn't have good strike, or especially back then, didn't right. have good striking. But like, if you look at like the Talis Latis fight, or if you look at the Patrick Cote fight, he likes to lay back and let guys come to him. And when guys just stand there and wait for him to come, the fights get really boring. Like, he was involved in a few stinkers that everybody kind of forgot about.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because he's not really he's not the attacking style of fighter. Like, there's some guys that just fucking attack. They just go, like Rumble. Like, Anthony right. Johnson goes after you.
Right.
Bell rings, he's charging at you, throwing bombs. Yeah. Anderson has never been that kind of a fighter. He's
right.
always been, like, much more of a tactician. And then there's always the air of invincibility.
Right.
But that air of invincibility is gone.
Yeah, it's gone.
It's
now.
Just completely gone.
It's gone. I think it's gone.
It was so weird seeing him, like, weeping after the fight, too. And then Nick goes and picks him up. That was pretty badass.
Yeah.
You know, and Nick was like, come on, man, you can't be crying.
Yeah,
you're the greatest of all time. You can't be crying.
You know, Nick and Nate, they get painted to be these, like, bad guys. And, you know, that's part of the persona that, you know, they promote. And that's all well and good. But, like, they're very, very respectful. You know, when he... when Nick beat Frank Shamrock, he was on the ground after the fight, and Nick reached down and picked him up and said, you know, you're a legend, you can't be on the floor, stand up or whatever.
Yeah.
And this is, but all people see is, you know, they go for the stare down in the press conference, and Nick flicks him off, and Frank Shamrock grabs his balls, but you
right.
know, they're both very respectful fighters, and, you know, I think they get a bad rap sometimes.
Well, he definitely gets crazy before the fight and anxious, but that's to be expected. And the shit-talking, look, Sun Tzu said it in The Art of War. You know, Miyamoto Musashi talked about it in The Book of Five Rings. There's all sorts of things that go on in a fight.
Mm-hmm.
And in any contest, there's advantages to be had. And there's mental advantages that if you do not take advantage of those mental advantages and your opponent does, you're at a disadvantage. And when Nick immediately starts the fight and he's like, he's got his hands out to Anderson, like, what, bitch? What, bitch? And he's walking towards him. Come on, what the fuck are you going to do? Come on, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And you see him talking, like, constantly talking. And you just see Anderson, like, people get flustered
oh, yeah,
when
dude.
Nick does that.
Big time. He Nick? Does it in sparring, too.
Does he really?
Yeah, he does that shit in sparring. The first time I met Nick, I was brought in for actually the Nate's fight with Donald Cerrone. And when I got to the gym, Nate had hurt his neck or something, was going to had to go to the chiropractor or something, and they were like, oh, just wait, Nick will be here, you can spar with Nick. And I was like, okay. So like, Nick shows up, and I'm a big fan of these guys, you know, like, it's just, I was kind of like, you know, a little starstruck. And Nick shows up and he's just, what's up? Yeah. And I'm like, I tell the coach that brought me in, I was like, so what, are we gonna spar or are we gonna fight right now? He's like, you're gonna fight right now. And I was like, all right. You know, and but it was just like he walks into the cage, you know, kind of like just looking me up and down kind of thing. And then, you know, we sparred and it was really hard. We had like a really good, a really hard session. And then after that, he was like, kickboxing, huh? So, yeah, you want to hang out after? You know, we started hanging out after that. But it was very much like his, you know, that's who he is, you know. It's
Yeah, what kind of insight can you give us to why is he like that? Like, what is, what's going on behind the eyes?
Honestly, I couldn't, you know, I spent, Nick's a good friend of mine. I couldn't tell you what the hell is going on in his head. 90%
That's just
of the
who
time.
He is, huh?
You know, it's just, I think he gets people thinking like he doesn't know what he's doing or he's crazy, but I guarantee, like, he, once you figure out he knows exactly what he's doing all the time, like there's a plan, which there totally is, then, you know, but you worry about him sometimes. Like, what's he doing? You know?
Well, he's an enigma. In far as
it
like,
really
you look at the way he behaves, you go, oh, okay, well, this is like a thug who's a street guy. And then you find out, oh, no, no, no. He's on this incredibly clean, organic diet.
Oh, yeah.
He runs triathlons on a regular basis. The fucking guy swims back from Alcatraz. I mean, he's an incredible endurance athlete. This is not like a dummy. This is a very calculated guy, legit black belt in jiu-jitsu, like very, very good on the ground. Mm-hmm. His boxing's outstanding. Like, there's too much good. There's too much preparation, too much discipline, too much intelligence in the way he carries himself inside the competition. Mm-hmm. He's not dumb at all.
He's not dumb.
No,
he's very smart. And like,
he's an enigma.
Yeah, some of the stuff he talks about is just like, you know, I want to like take notes, you know, like the diet stuff. He's always on me, my shit. I drink rock stars and energy drinks and, you know, smoke cigarettes from time to time.
Do you?
He's very much not.
Did the cigarette thing come from Thai, from training Muay Thai? Because so many Thais smoke cigarettes.
It started when I was a kid, you know. My dad always smoked, my stepmom always smoked, my brothers, I'm the youngest of three, they always smoked. I'm from Ohio, everybody was smoking back in the day, and I started when I was a kid. And then I think when I started doing kickboxing, it was more like, okay, like there was other, I made excuses, there was other people that smoked cigarettes kind of thing. I mean, I don't advocate it at all, but I'm not, you know.
How often do you smoke cigarettes?
I smoke cigarettes pretty often.
Really?
Yeah.
Like right now? You smoking right now while you're in training?
Yep.
No shit.
Yeah.
Like a pack a day?
I try to cut back, you know, when I'm having fights, just because, you know, I'm running, I'm training really hard, but yeah, I'm a regular smoker of cigarettes.
Jesus Christ, Joe.
Yeah, it's that,
that's fucking terrible.
I'm not going to hide who I am. You know, some people do, have vices and whatnot.
But what's incredible is you fought in that fucking Glory tournament, which was a brutal tournament, which I went to in LA. It was amazing. That fight with Simon Marcus, when it went into the fourth round, you caught him with that right hand. First of all, that is a fucking war for one fight.
Yeah.
But the fact that you had to fight three fucking times in a night against world-class fighters like that, Wayne Barrett in your next fight, Jesus Christ. And then Levin, right? Mm-hmm. Levin in the finals, who's one of the best in the world.
Yeah, man.
That is a crazy fucking night of combat.
Yeah, it was nuts.
What
it
the
nuts.
Fuck is the next day feel like
oh my
after
God.
That?
Man, it was terrible.
How many cigarettes did you smoke the next day?
I gotta, man, I can't believe I'm saying this. So after, don't smoke cigarettes, kids. It's bad for you.
Don't smoke, kids.
Don't smoke. It's really
Listen,
bad.
Listen, Uncle Joe.
And like, people, you constantly hear shit from people like Joe, you know, and Nick and all of the other people. You don't get people don't respect you as much when you smoke cigarettes and make dumb choices like that. In the fighting community, you know, it is what it is. But
well, you have great cardio, which is weird.
I train really hard. I'm a very hard worker. When it's time to buckle down, like I buckle down.
But how much of an edge do you think you would have more if you didn't have cigarettes?
I've thought about that for a long time.
Like, goddamn, dude.
Probably would have more of an edge, but like,
you might be the baddest motherfucker ever if you quit cigarettes.
That's true. Well, I don't think I'm that far off from it now, to be honest with you.
You're pretty close.
Pretty close.
You're pretty close.
But after I knocked out Simon in the Glory tournament, we're in the back dressing room, and you know they want me to lay down and ice me and all that stuff, and I'm like, hey, coach, let's go outside. Let's go.
You smoked a cigarette in between the fights?
I went outside after Simon and had my hands wrapped and walking out. And the security's like, where are you going? I'm like, oh, I'll be right back. Smoked a cigarette. Calmed down a little bit. Felt a little better. And then, I felt – it was such an insane night that night. After the Simon fight, I was really pumped, but like I was banged up. But I felt I was really on like this high from beating him. And he had beat me twice in the past, and it was really – that was a big moment for me. And then the Wayne Barrett fight was just a really frustrating, it was a really mentally challenging fight. You know, his style really, the first time we fought, it really frustrated me. And I did what Anderson did with Weidman the first time. I kind of cracked under like the frustration. I put my hands on my hips and, you know, I kind of gave away the fight.
What style, like describe his style?
It's very different. It's almost like he makes it up. He's got very strong boxing. He's got heavy hands. He's very big. He was the first person I fought at 185 where the guy that I weighed in against and the guy I got in the ring with were two very different sizes, you know, and that messed with me a little bit. But he was running away. He was trying to use his movement, and every time I would try to throw, I just got really frustrated by him not engaging me, you know. And that was something I had to really learn from. And going into the second fight, I was ready for that, prepared for it, and I knew it was going to be an ugly fight, and it wasn't going to be a you know, the type of fight that I really liked. Simon is the type of guy I like to fight. You know, I like to be in essentially like a war, but let's fight, let's get it on, you know. And Wayne was like stepping backwards and putting his foot on the rope and jumping off the ropes and like doing like a lot of weird stuff that was just frustrating for me. So I had to stay focused on that fight, and then I got the W. I honestly didn't know who won the fight because it was so, neither one of us were really scoring, but you know, after watching the video, I see that I won the fight. And then, so I had about 30 minutes after the Simon fight before I got up for Wayne, but after the Wayne fight, it was like, go in the back, change your gloves, and there was like one fight between us. I think it was like 9 minutes before I was back in the ring again. And
whoa.
I was walking to the ring, and I just kept thinking, like, how the fuck am I going to do it? Like, what am I? This is, I looked at my call, I'm like, this is fucking crazy. And Nick was in the back, and he was just like, I don't know how the fuck you're going to do this, dude. Like, my legs were just knotted all up and down. My face hurt from headbutts and getting dropped. When Simon dropped me in the second round in the first fight, he hit me right on the chin, and it didn't really affect me mentally. I never got rocked by it. My legs went out right away, and I felt all of the punch, like, in my neck. It was like, pop, pop, in my neck. And, walking out to fight Artem, I was just really proud that I had the balls, I guess, to do what I was doing. Like, I was more, like, in shock of what I was capable of. But I really didn't feel like I had anything left to win the fight, you know? But I was on my way to the ring. I was just really proud.
Archaic shit, those three fights in one night. To get world-class fighters to fight three times in one night. Like, I went there and I talked to Kevin Kay, who, you know, is one of the big wigs over at Spike. And I said, this is awesome. You know, this event is awesome. These fighters are awesome. It's so cool that you guys have world-class kickboxing. I go, but fuck all this crazy fighting three fights in one night. I go, this is dangerous.
Yeah.
This is not smart. If you guys lose somebody because of this, if someone dies, like a world-class guy dies because of this, you guys look like assholes. Like, don't do this anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's that dramatic. I mean, I guess it could be if a guy gets through. You're right, it could be.
If you have a war, if a guy has a war with another guy and gets dropped three or four times in a fight, like, you know, some fucking George Foreman, Ron Lyle type shit,
right,
where they're just blasting each other back and forth, and one guy manages to just get through by the skin of his teeth, mm-hmm. and then he gets head kicked an hour later by somebody else, that shit is no bueno.
Right.
You know, and that is a possibility. Like, you fight, you should fight once in a night, you know, you're in camp, you're training for a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously you can do it, you did it, mm-hmm. but if you had your choice to be at your best to fight a guy like Levin,
yeah.
you know, you want to be at your best. You want to go through a full training camp,
right.
and you don't want to have two fights that fucking day,
right.
9 minutes before you fight one of the best kickboxers on earth.
And it's like, when you're going into that tournament, and both times that I fought Levin, your training camp is for that first fight, you know? And then in the back of your mind somewhere, it's like, oh, well, if I get to the next round, like, if it could be this guy, it could be that guy. You kind of try to get some sort of game plan for everybody, but then the third fight after that, you're just, you know, I hadn't even thought about getting to Levin in that tournament or how I was going to fight him. It was beating Simon, who had beat me twice, you know, and then beating Wayne. And then, you know, it was just, it was really tough. And yeah, neither one, I mean, I wasn't at my best. Obviously, I was all beat up when I fought him. So I think the fans deserve to see, and the same thing with the first time I fought Levin. It was the second fight in the tournament that we fought. And, yeah, it would be really nice to see really who is the best, who's the, you know, on when they're on their game.
Yeah, that's true, right? The first time you fought him was the second fight in a tournament too.
Mm-hmm.
That's so crazy, man.
Yeah.
And
that tournament was nuts because I was supposed to fight Steve Wakeling, which at the time was the number two guy in the world. And then I knew that I would be fighting Levin in the final just because of his matchup. And like 6 days before the fight, Wakeling pulled out of the fight and they gave me Kingo Shimizu, who I'd never heard of, who was like the Japanese champion who used to fight at heavyweight and was coming down to middleweight. And, you know, I had like 6 days to watch tape on him and try to figure out a strategy. So,
well, Levin's such a slippery guy, too. You were the first guy to ever catch him like mm-hmm. that. You know, you had him really fucking hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I thought he was done. Like, kudos to that guy for getting through it, because you cracked him and then on the way down, you caught him with a knee.
I think that knee actually woke him up, to be honest. The more I watch it, I was like, he was dropping. Like, he was out on the way down. And then my knee, I think it was like that second impact, like, kind of brought him back. But, yeah, I couldn't believe he got
it. How weird is it that that's real? Like, guys have been knocked back awake.
Right.
Like, knocked out, and then, boom, they get hit again. And then all of a sudden, they're back in the fight. It's mm-hmm. very
strange.
We see
it a lot in the UFC where these guys are, you know, out limp. And then right when the ref breaks them, they're going for a leg, or, you know, they're coming back too, sort of.
Yeah, you see guys have their eyes roll back behind their head, and then they get hit again, and it's almost like they refocus, like the new jolt of electricity to their brain, like clear.
Yeah.
You know, it's very weird.
That's another thing, like with, you've seen it with like Dan Henderson in some of those fights, you're like, oh, he's out, and then he comes back. Or like Chet Congo in his fight with, I can't remember his name. The other guy.
Pat Barry.
You know, like he was gone and then came back and hit him, you know. So
that Pat Barry fight with Muay Casa was hard to watch.
Yeah.
That was hard to watch. Pat Barry is a great guy. I love that dude. He's such a fun dude. But, man, he's had some rough KOs over the last couple of years where he had never been KO'd, and then he gets KO'd by Congo, and then he gets KO'd by LeVar Johnson. Mm-hmm. But the Muay Casa one was hard to watch. Yeah. That was hard to watch.
That was a hell of a shot. I really like that guy, Zach. He seems like a really, really good guy.
Yeah.
It was cool. I was happy for him, but, yeah, it was
He seems like a really good guy. But he's another one. Like, he's not built like a fighter. He's built like some crazy giant bodybuilder dude, which is great for like a round and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into the third round or fourth or fifth if you're fighting a championship fight. And like, you know, you saw he fought two fights in one night in that last tournament.
Right.
And in the second tournament, he just was a different guy. He's just a different guy. Like, whereas you can be the same guy for the first round as you can for the fifth round.
Mm-hmm.
Those big guys, what we were saying earlier about cutting all that weight,
right.
They just, when you have that much muscle to feed, like, there's definitely benefits. You could bum rush a guy and you're just a machine for as long as you have oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
But there's that weird middle balance where you're trying to find the comfortable middle ground between being ridiculously strong and being an endurance athlete.
Yeah, Terry Sokoju had issues with that, right?
I mean, yeah.
When he first came on the scene in Pride, he's like, not like, just who the hell is this guy? And he knocks out Arona, knocks out Nogueira, and then the UFC, you could see like he was really strong, and then he would kind of fade in the later rounds. So.
I think he has mental issues too.
Yeah.
I think there's a little bit of a confidence issue too when it comes to when you talk to the people that have trained with him and the people in his camp. You know, sometimes guys get through that. You know, Vitor went through a long stage where he had confidence issues, and he got through that. Some, you know, it's not insurmountable, but yeah, definitely the muscle, packing all that muscle is not good for you. It's just, it doesn't help. You know, it helps a little. It makes you really strong if you're a grappler. You know, it could certainly give you some advantage, but those guys, man, if you're built like that and you're trying to fight five rounds, man, you're taking a crazy gamble. And that gamble is, I'm going to get this guy out of there in the first couple of rounds.
And then you got a guy like we were talking about, Cain Velasquez. Who's just, he's huge, but has like ridiculous cardio. You know, it's a.
He's a freak.
Humans are just so weird, right?
Yeah. They vary so much, man. They vary so much. You know, you get guys that, like, you know, you remember Cabbage?
Yeah.
Back in the old days.
Oh, man, I love Cabbage.
Cabbage was awesome, dude.
That was awesome.
You could hit Cabbage with a fucking tree.
Yep.
You could pull a tree out of the roots and clang it off the side of his head, and he would smile at you. You know, that guy could just take this unbelievable punch.
Yeah.
And that's just biological. He's just born that way.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, somebody told me the other day I had a great chin, or Nick had a great, somebody said something about having a great chin, and I said, you know, don't ever say that about me. You know, when people start telling you you can take a great shot or you have a great chin, it means your defense is bad. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it only lasts so long, and then, you know, you see it. One guy can go, you know, take shots forever, and then one fight later, he cannot take a shot, like Chuck Liddell.
Chuck Liddell.
And
Dan Henderson, his last fight against Musasi.
Right.
Musasi hit him with a punch that Dan would have eaten like a Tic Tac earlier in his career, and his legs go.
Mm-hmm.
It's just everybody's got a certain amount of holes in their ticket.
Jermaine Taylor was like that, too.
Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah,
after Kelly Pavlik knocked him out,
mm-hmm.
he was a fantastic boxer. Still had all the skills, but just couldn't take a punch anymore.
Yeah, this is just a point where you reach, where you're, you know. And it's also how you prepare, right? Like, how many shots are you taking in the gym?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how are you training? Are you training smart defensively? Some guys are just fucking full pedal to the metal offense. You know, that's how they train. That's how they think. That's how they fight. And then when it comes to defensive skills, like, they might have like an A+ for an offense, but their defense might be like a C.
Right.
You know, and then when it starts going their way and they clang up, they don't know what to do. They have to think instead of just being instinctive and rolling with stuff because it's a natural part of your everyday thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's a weird thing about fighting, man. It's like how much emphasis, especially when it comes to MMA, how much emphasis to put on striking, how much emphasis to put on grappling, how much emphasis to put on your cardio and strength and conditioning, and how much to put on skills.
And I think that a huge part of that that's missing, I think, in a lot of people, or even just in this conversation, is like the mental aspect. You know, you can train perfect. You could have a decent weight cut. You could do everything correctly, and that 2 hours before the fight, from the time you check in to the time that you walk out in that ring, if you're not mentally strong enough and prepared for that, you just don't perform. You know what I mean? And, you know, was Anderson Silva that prepared for Nick to lay down and start heckling him? You know,
most certainly not.
You know, was a lot of the – so I think like, for me, I hired a mind coach when I first started with Glory, and it's been a huge it's been a huge change in my career.
Now, when you say a mind coach, that's mm-hmm. interesting that you say it. Like, it's not like a sports psychologist. Mm-hmm. You call them a mind coach.
Yeah.
And what do they do with you?
His name is Vinny Shorman. He's out of the UK. He's actually an announcer for – he's like probably one of the most busy, active kickboxing announcers in the world. He used to do K1 and Showtime. He's been around kickboxing, you know, for a long, long time. He does all kinds of really cool stuff with me. You know, I don't want to give away too many secrets, but he can, he does like hypnosis on me sometimes. But
does
like,
he live in the UK?
Or he lives in the UK, and like he'll hypnotize me through FaceTime over the phone. Swear to God, it happened. And like the first time he did it, like so he had been posting, and I had heard about him a little bit, and I had some issues in the past where like my worst performances were not because I didn't train hard. It was a mental thing, you know, and, the first time I started talking to him, he like wanted to hypnotize me, and I'm like, okay, yeah, sure, you're gonna hypnotize me. And he's like, okay, I want you to sit down, and you know, you're gonna start feeling blah 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 blah. And as he's talking, I'm like, just quietly with my eyes closed, I'm like, this dude's so full of shit. This is not gonna work. This is not gonna work. This guy's so dumb. And the next thing I know, I'm like, and you know, it worked immediately. And the little things that he told me to do, I immediately felt a lot better, and I could see the difference. My coach could see the difference. And
what's his background? Is he a psychologist?
I think I'm not really sure how he got into that. It's he does like a lot of seminars and goes to a lot of things and studies a lot of stuff. I don't really know his if he went to school for that or what that is, but he's very, very good at what he does. He works with Liam Harrison, he works with Jordan Watson, he worked with Julie Kitchen, he worked with Andy Housen, most of like the really high level kickboxers overseas.
That is a very important point, you know, and I don't know how many guys utilize sports psychologists. I know Anderson did a bit for this fight after the Weidman fight.
I would think
some
that
issues.
Would be really important for him.
Yeah.
You know, going in stuff like this. And a lot of guys, like, you bring it up and they can immediately see it as a disadvantage that you even think that you need help or that you, you know, but for me, there's so many things like, fans don't understand the amount of pressure that a fighter is under going into a fight. And then to go into a fight where the whole world thinks you're going to lose, you know what I mean? That you have no chance. Like, what, like me fighting Cal Clay, I think I had 9 professional fights. And, you know, he knocked out Mighty Mo, and he was a Roger Dumner champion at over 200
fights. If you don't know who he is, he's a world-famous Thai boxer who was about 175, 180 pounds. Mm-hmm. Fought Mighty Mo, who was close to 300 pounds mm-hmm. at the time, and head kicked him.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those ridiculous K1 matchups where they used to do. In Japan, they love freak shows. Mm-hmm. They love to put together Nogueira versus Bob Sapp, where Bob Sapp's 375 pounds. And, you know, they put Bob Sapp versus, even crazier, they put Bob Sapp versus Manoa, who's like 185. So you got a
who
guy.
Was it? Was Genki Sudo versus the Samoan guy?
Genki Sudo also fought fucking the fat guy with the ball, Butterbean.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
The heel hook Butterbean.
Yeah.
That shit was ridiculous.
Yeah.
We're talking about more than a 200-pound weight disadvantage.
And to go on the ground and him on top of you. You know,
yeah. Just, unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, but they don't give a fuck in Japan. Yeah. They want to put on Godzilla versus King Kong. That's what they want to do. They want to have ridiculous matchups.
And I want to watch Godzilla versus King Kong. You know, I'm into that. You know?
I am
sometimes
too.
They say, like, styles make fights. And, like, sometimes it's... I mean, obviously you want to see who's the best of the best of the best, but sometimes you want to see these other, you know, these two might not be even in the top 10, but man, they're going to fucking get down, you know. Those are the fights I want to see.
Yeah, I mean, look, Bob Sapp versus Nogueira to me still is one of my favorite all-time mm-hmm. fights because it was so ridiculous. And the fact you got pile-drived in the first round, mm-hmm. which you never see in MMA, it's kind of illegal. It's illegal in the U.S. at least.
Speaking of illegal, can we talk about this? Joe, I think we can talk about this.
Sure.
What's up with all these guys smashing, trying to stomp kick like Anderson did to Nick? You know,
kicking the knees. Yeah,
I just think it's a little shady that your guy comes off with such a catastrophic injury, and the first thing he does is start stomping away at somebody else's kneecap in a fight.
Did you see the fight with Miguel Torres, the kickboxing fight, the recent fight?
I did.
Jamie, pull this up. Miguel Torres. Knee destroyed. Yeah. You'll find it.
Or it's like legacy kickboxing.
Yeah, it's probably GIF. You can find the GIF file of it. It's fucking horrendous. Yeah. It's the worst one I've ever seen. He does this the oblique kick, and he does it right to the knee on like the side of his knee. And his knee just you see it get destroyed.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I just don't think that's. I don't think it should be legal. I just don't think you should be. You know, I'm trying to knock somebody out. I'm not trying to like actually kill them and finish their career. But I think if you start messing around, because I've had two knee surgeries and had to come back from them, and it's just, I don't know. It bothers me to see somebody intentionally try to attack a knee joint.
But what do you think about?
But
heel
then again,
hooks,
you arm bar, so you know it is what
right. What about heel hooks? Like if you see a guy like Husamar Pajares, who's a heel hook specialist.
I don't necessarily have a problem with the heel hook. I have a problem with a guy that holds on to the heel hook after you tap multiple times and then intentionally rips your leg off and then
which he really does.
You know, I don't really care for that.
Yeah, the heel hook's a particularly devastating one to hang on to. Like if you hang on to a choke, you put the guy out. But with folks who've never trained, you don't like it's not that bad to get choked unconscious. I know it seems like it would be really bad, but it really is just like it shuts your brain off and then turns your brain back on again. It's sort of the best way to describe it is like a garden hose. You pinch a garden hose, it stops the water, and then you let it go, and then the water goes flowing through it. It's not nearly as bad as getting knocked out. So holding onto a choke and putting a guy unconscious, it's really not that big a deal. But holding on to a heel hook, you tear the ligaments apart, and you're talking about a guy who's going to go through 6 months of rehab, surgery, the whole deal, and then it might not ever be the same.
Yeah, you're taking away a guy's livelihood for over a year.
Most likely a year.
You already got him to tap or whatever.
Yeah.
I just don't particularly.
Well, Pajares is kind of crazy. There's something. There's a little bit of a mental issue. You know about his childhood, right? His whole story. Is really heart-wrenching. I mean, he was working full-time from the time he was like a little boy in a farm. You know that giant scar that he has on his chest?
Right.
He got that when he was working, and he had to crazy glue it together because like they had no money for food, they had no money for the doctor. Like he used to eat pig slop because he had no food. Like he would eat like the food that they would feed pigs. It's horrific.
Wow.
So this guy like he went through some really horrendous shit, like as a child in rural Brazil, you know, in intense poverty. So I think it's hard to get through that unscathed, and
right.
He most certainly hasn't. So I think every fight that he has, man, he's fucking fighting for his life.
Right.
And if he gets a hold of your leg, he could see this.
Ugh, it just sucks.
What's that? It's loading up. Yeah, look at this. I mean, he caught it sideways too. Miguel was heavy on the front leg, and he almost kind of like stepped in sideways. Oh, the dude caught it like just in the outside. Look at that. Oh my goodness.
Oh. See, I throw like a similar kick to that where I take the front of my foot and it's almost like a slap kick, and I do it to the shin bone, but it's not to injure him. It's to stop his forward momentum. A lot of times when I do that, their head comes forward and I can throw something. But to go directly in the knee joint, I mean, that guy threw that intentionally to do that. You know, I don't think there's any question that he was trying to buckle his knee like that.
He's attacking the knee. Yeah. And that's
it. Look how he's coming down. Ugh.
Yeah, well, it's actually Miguel was stepping forward, so his knee was off the mat like as it landed. See that? Oh, it was kind of touching, but he was coming forward, and the guy caught. Yeah, see, his knee came up. And he's coming forward, and then it just went down on it and just wrenched it across. Oh, it's horrible to watch.
Yeah.
Oh, and that's you're out for a year.
Yeah,
you know, if it might not ever be the same again.
If you come back,
they're doing this new thing now, man, where they're 3D mapping your meniscus. They're taking this thing that they've created. It's like a scaffolding. They 3D map this scaffolding. They insert it where your meniscus is, and it has proteins in it, and your body builds your own meniscus on it.
That's awesome.
So you're going to be able to rebuild your meniscus.
That's awesome.
It's incredible.
That's, for years, that's been the thing they can't change. You know?
Yeah.
So if you tear your meniscus, like, you're screwed. That's really good that they can do that.
Well, they've cartilage, too. Cartilage. They've started to do that with stem cells. They've started to inject stem cells into the area where people are missing cartilage, and cartilage regrows, which is incredible.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, they're doing some cool shit.
They did, PRP stuff, too, where they, mm-hmm. they I remember with my knee surgery, they were thinking about doing that with mine. They didn't do it.
But. Platelet-rich plasma is really cool. Right. And there's another thing that I've been doing called Regenikine. And Regenikine's amazing.
It's
That's the stuff that was invented by this guy, I forget his name, but he's in Germany. And he created this procedure where you take the blood, they pull it out, like a lot of blood, and then they spin it in a centrifuge and heat it up. And when they heat it up, it takes the blood, and the blood reacts to the heat as if you have a fever, and it creates this amazing anti-inflammatory response. Mm. It's this yellow serum. They pull this yellow serum out, and then they inject it directly into any area where you have an injury. And it's like platelet-rich plasma times 100. It's
cool.
Amazing.
That makes sense. It's like the cold laser therapy, where they're like light therapy. Like, that's what they do to me a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A therapy. You're essentially the light or the heat triggers your body to send more blood and nutrients and heal itself.
Yeah,
so they're just straight heating that stuff up and injecting it back in you. Huh?
Yeah, it's amazing, awesome. Man. It's amazing.
Science.
I've had it done on my knee, my neck, my back, my elbow, my shoulder. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Every time some shit's fucked up on me, I just go right down there and get shot up.
And you feel the difference right away?
Oh, yeah, man. My knee was fucking with me. I've had 3 knee surgeries, and my knee was fucking with me for, like, the last couple of years. I was like, man, I might have to get this fucking thing scoped again.
Yeah.
And I get it shot up, like, 5 months ago. Nothing. Squats, kickboxing, nothing.
No
just pop, never fucks with
everything.
Me.
That's
just
awesome.
Never fucks with me anymore. It's weird.
That's amazing.
So they can do incredible shit now with medicine and science. Thank God there's so many eggheads out there that are just fucking pounding on the keyboards and, you know, doing in the lab and trying to re-engineer human beings.
Right.
It's amazing.
Well, it's like what Anderson and Tyrone Spong, that break, like, 15 years ago, they would have, like, amputated your leg. Like, it would have just been, that would have been that. You
really?
Know what I mean? Yeah, somebody was telling me that the
other day.
They
used to amputate legs for that kind of break?
Yeah, if the leg snaps and, like, they said they would amputate.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
Because of the something about the tissue or something.
Just 15 years ago?
Something like that, yeah.
That's hard to believe.
Don't quote me on that, but that's what I heard.
Somebody might have lied to you.
Someone probably lied to me. I'm pretty gullible.
Well, they probably used to have to, like,
Joe might be lying to us all right now about this gold stuff they're re-injecting. I don't know.
No, man. That stuff's Dana White is the one who told me about it. He had it done for his Meniere's disease. Meniere's disease is something you have in the inner ear, and it was fucked with him his whole life. He had surgery to try to fix it, and he got shot up with this the Regenikine, and just bang, gone. Just goes away.
I wonder if that would help Nick. Nick hurt his left elbow, like hyperextended his left elbow when we were training, like maybe 3 or 4 weeks before the fight, and it really started messing with him like the week before the fight. And we were in Vegas, and his manager actually called Dana to find out, you know, what doctor or whatever to go to get him a cortisone shot into his elbow.
Mm-hmm.
And Nick won't even take ibuprofen. I was like, dude, take some ibuprofen.
Why won't he take ibuprofen?
I don't know. I think it was about, he used to cut really easily back in the day. Ibuprofen's like a blood thinner sort of thing or something that he thinks it makes him bleed more or whatnot.
Hmm.
But he was having, like, we were walking around the hotel, and like if his arm would lock out, and like he would have to wait a second for it to like click back. So it was.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and then you're going into a fight where your boxing is your strong suit, and you don't feel really comfortable throwing your left hand. So
that's ridiculous.
But
I
wonder if that gold stuff would have helped.
Yeah,
but
I guarantee
he got through
you.
It, and he landed some good shots with it. So
he definitely did. Well, once that adrenaline starts flowing,
that's what I was telling him. Like, you're not going to think about that when you're out there. You know.
Yeah, the Regenikine thing is all the rage. Like, all the basketball players, like Kobe Bryant gets it done. All these different guys get it done. Guys were flying over to Germany to do it,
really?
But now they have an office in Santa Monica, and I think they have an office in Dallas, I think, as well. They have a couple of them that they're opening up. They might be opening up one in Vegas, but they're opening up all over the country because the response is amazing.
That's nuts.
Yeah, we live in a weird time. Yeah. Science is amazing.
It's amazing. It really is.
I just got done today. I was doing cryotherapy. Have you done that yet?
I haven't done it. I wanted to go to one, especially after the Last Man Standing tournament. My entire body was just messed up. I had this, it still kind of messes with me a little bit now, but somehow along the line of the three fights, I got hit in the chest with something. I want to say it was probably Simon with one of those knees, but like my whole body hurt, and then as the swelling and everything started going down, my fucking chest just started killing me.
Like your sternum?
Yeah, and it was like, then I noticed I had like this ball. It was literally like the size of like a tennis ball on my chest. It still swells up a little bit now. But it swelled up so much that it pinched off all the nerves in my chest. And then, like, my arm would, like, I'd have, like, stingers all the way down my arm. And I'd wake up, I mean, for the first, like, week or two after the fight, I was, like, waking up in the middle of the night, like, shaking. I would get a fever because I was in so much pain from this nerve stuff. And I guess I got, like, multiple x-rays, thought my sternum was broken, couldn't figure it out, there was no break. And they said it was basically, like, you know, you see these guys where they get hit in the face or hit in the head and they get these hematomas on their head, and it's just blood and crap that's stuck between the skin and the bone. Well, mine was, I guess, inside of the cartilage of my rib or whatever. And, you know, even for the Melvin fight, when I would be training jiu-jitsu or I'd be working on my chokes or somebody puts their weight on my chest, like it would swell up afterwards. So I was taking ibuprofen by like the handful there for a minute. But it's doing a lot better now.
Yeah, the cryotherapy probably helped out a little bit, but I think that's just one of those things that's got to heal, right, too. The cryotherapy is awesome for recovery.
Yeah.
That's what it's amazing for.
Yeah, I do ice baths. I mean, I think the cryotherapy is a lot shorter. It seems like a lot cooler.
A lot shorter and apparently a lot more effective.
Really?
Because you're going 250 degrees below zero for 3 minutes. Then you get out, you get on the elliptical machine, you warm your body back up, and then boom, right back in for another 3 minutes.
What's that feeling?
Dude, it feels amazing. You get out of there, you feel like you could fucking jump over the moon.
Really?
It's amazing. It's wild. Like, if you could take that in a pill form, people would just be fucking chewing on them all day. Because most people are scared of the feeling, like, fucking 250 degrees. It's really not that bad. It's really not. You just kind of stand there. I mean, I don't even freak out. I just kind of move around a little. It hurts my nipples, so I cover my nipples up when I do it. I don't know why. I don't want my nipples to fall off. Not that I use them or anything. They're pretty numb anyway. But that's the only thing that starts to like feel like really bad. I mean, your legs get super cold towards the end, but it's just 3 minutes, you know. Yeah. You just kind of deal with it for 3 minutes, and then you get out, and you as soon as you get out, you're like, woo-hoo-hoo!
Yeah.
As soon as your body realizes it's back in
you
room
feel
temperature. Well, the blood, apparently, the science behind it is your body thinks this motherfucker's going to die. Okay, yeah. Somebody just dropped you off at the top of the world, and it's 0 degrees below zero, and you're going to die within moments. So your
it pulls
body
all the blood to your organs.
Yeah, to your organs, try to protect your organs. And then once you get back to room temperature, it pushes it all out, and it creates this amazing anti-inflammatory effect. Mm-hmm. Like all the soreness that you have, and it just does a weird thing to your body. But the energy that you get out of it, I don't know if it's an adrenaline rush, if your body realizes like, hey, we're not going to die. Life is beautiful.
Yeah.
Look, the sun is shining. I'm alive. You know, it's like one of those things where they say, you don't really appreciate peace unless you've experienced war. You don't appreciate love unless you experience hate.
Right.
You don't know how beautiful it is to be able to walk down the street and not freeze your dick off until you're inside one of those booths. But there's a lot of physical effects.
Yeah, I got to try that. That sounds really cool.
Yeah, you can research it online, like all the different, what they know about the actual biochemical effect that it has on your body. But people swear by it. Like, again, like basketball players, MMA fighters, like Alan Joban, who's one of our guys at 10th Planet. He's in there every day. Eddie Bravo does it every day. It's amazing. When he was training for the Hoyler fight, too, especially, he was in there every day. It's amazing. It just makes you recover quicker, but the feeling you get out of it, I love the best. I walk out of there, it's like your whole body feels alive. It's wild.
Yeah,
I'll take you. When you come back, let me know. Okay. I'll take you down there.
Yeah, definitely.
Introduce you to those guys.
There's a lot of cool science, actually, with like cold therapy. After the Last Man Standing tournament I was thinking about doing, I don't know why I didn't end up doing it, but Nike makes a cooling vest that it's basically like has all these pockets there's pockets in it, and it it keeps you like really cold. So I was thinking after the fight of putting that on, because I found out that like 75%, again, don't quote me on these numbers, but 75% of the your energy system is spent on temperature regulation. So, like, if you had to have multiple fights in one night, you know, how much time are you wasting sitting in the back sweating, and that you're wasting energy that you need later on in the fight? So we were thinking about trying to put to use that cold pack or those cooling vests. I think Nike came out with it for the Beijing Olympics.
That's a great. You have two fights this weekend?
No, I just have one.
This
fight.
Is one beautiful.
Which honestly nice. Seems like, you know, my coach is like, oh, you know, my cardio is not quite as good as I thought it was, and he's like, you only got to fight once. And I was like, oh, all right, yeah. It's hard to compare because when you know you get in such. I mean, I was in phenomenal shape for that Last Man Standing tournament. I think I had, like, we found out about that fight, I think, 4 or 5 months in advance, and I was going pretty hard for it the whole time. And
now, when you have a camp like that, like, who structures your camp? Like, who structures, like, how much running you do, how much strength and conditioning you do, how much kickboxing, how much striking with on the pads? I mean, like, how do you structure your workouts?
My coach would do that, but with that camp, it was like, okay, because we just came back from the Wayne Barrett fight where he just seemed like a lot bigger than me. So I was like, you know, I was fighting at 175 before I signed with Glory. And then when I went to Glory, it was automatically up to like 187 and 186. And, you know, the Glory 10 tournament, Artem Levin wasn't a very big guy. And Kingo Shimizu worked out really well for me. So I thought I was good at that size. And then with Wayne Barrett, he was just so massive. Like, he's just a big guy, you know? And so I wanted to put on some muscle. So we did a lot of strength conditioning. Just I was doing like, every day, sometimes twice a day, I was doing going to LA Fitness with my buddy and doing like strictly bodybuilding stuff, no cardio. Just I was shooting for like 3,500 calories a day, which is just I would feel lethargic and you know, just exhausted all the time. And I did that for a few months. I think I got up to about 215, which was really big for me at the time. And then I think it was probably the last like 5 weeks, I stopped with the strength conditioning and was just focused on speed and trying to get used to that size that I was. And I trimmed down quite a bit, but it was like build the muscle, bulk up, and then get fast and loose and then go into the tournament. And then my cardio and my speed and everything kind of comes in the last 4 weeks.
Yeah, there's a lot of guys who like to do that for MMA. Like, they take off from a fight, and then once they're done, or they get out of camp, if they know they have a fight 4 or 5 months away, they'll do nothing but strength and conditioning, no fight training, no sparring,
right.
You know, no getting hit, no grappling. They're just lifting weights and just, like, jumping boxes and doing all kinds of plyos and shit like that.
That was the first time I'd ever done that I really focused on the strength and conditioning stuff. And then when I did start when I stopped with that and I started, you know, doing the runs and stuff, Nick was actually in town and we went for a long run at Venice Beach. I think we were over at Rhonda's house that day and we went for like this long run. And we did like 6 mile run. I felt really good. And then I was like, hey, let's hit these sprints on the way back. And there's like bathroom and then it's like, you know, 200 yards and you have another bathroom or whatever. And he's like, okay, we'll run to the next bathroom, we'll sprint. And like, I was just in shock at how many gears I had. I was like, I'd never ran that fast ever in my whole life. And it was the difference of that time that I had bulked up and really worked on the strength conditioning. And then the period of cutting down and getting lean and getting fast again. And I was just very, very explosive. And it was a really good sign. I smoked Nick. Yeah. If you listen to this, Nick, I beat you. Big time.
That's interesting. So this is like, that's a direct result of all the weightlifting and all the putting on muscle and strength.
That was the first time I really noticed like a big difference because I always really hit hard. I mean, I think I've always hit really hard. But that was something I really noticed was my explosiveness out of my legs was definitely a lot better.
It's weird that for fighters, it seems like every training camp is almost like a science project. Like you're trying to figure out what is the right mixture.
Mm-hmm. And also, back to the mental thing, I think that's, you know, I always say, like, I'm trying to get, like, the tip of, like, an arrow, you know what I mean? In each fight, I get kind of closer to that, and then, you know, you make a mistake or whatever, but I'm trying to get to this pinnacle of, like, mentally focused, you know what I'm saying?
Right, the perfect spot.
Perfect
edge.
Know? Do I get too pumped up before I fight? Was I too cold? Was I flat? Was I,
right.
Was I thinking about the right things? And, you know, that's what my mind coach really helps me is there's so many things going on in my head and he just tells me the right things to think. And, you know, a lot of it is also like the way you talk to yourself or about yourself, the way you describe yourself. You know, I used to say stuff like, you know, I have really good punches, but my kicks aren't that good. And he told me like, hey, you got to stop saying that stuff. I'm like, well, my kicks really aren't that good. And, well, you kind of self-sabotage yourself. You only allow yourself to get as good as you talk about yourself. If that makes sense at all.
And yeah. I think, you define yourself.
That's why I call it like mind coaching instead of like psychological, you know, psychologist or whatever.
Is right.
Just like my coach tells me, hey, you're dropping your hands, or you're doing this, or you're doing that, or you need to focus on this, this, and this. My mind coach is doing the same thing. And I think that I think everything has really come, the stars, so to speak, have all kind of aligned for me in the last couple of years. You know, I feel like I'm at an age now, I'm just turned 31, although I guess I can't change my Wikipedia page now.
Why was it say?
It says I'm 31. I was going to change it to like 26.
don't do it. It's a slippery slope.
Yeah, right.
I know guys that are 40-something. They try to say they're 30.
Yeah.
It's fucking ridiculous.
But I think, you know, I've reached an age in my career where I just, I'm a lot more mature. I'm a lot better athlete. And I, you know, it seems like everything's kind of lining up now, and I have the right coaches behind me. I've been with my coach, Mark Camoro, since I was fighting in amateur fights. You know, he's taken me throughout my whole career. So
that's great. Well, that's a guy who knows you really well then.
Yeah. I
mean, you train at the yard in LA?
Yep.
Where is the yard?
It's in Lincoln Heights right now. It's right outside. It's on Avenue 26. It's right where the 5 and the 110 meet.
So it's like downtown area.
Yeah, it's basically downtown.
Is it? That's a bitch to get to, isn't it? The fucking traffic sucks.
Well, I kind of live in like that general area. Like I live in Alhambra, like South Pasadena area. So it's not too bad for me. I was living in downtown for a long time, and then my son started going to schools, and I was like, you know, I'd rather have him in a little better school system. So
yeah,
the best school system we could, you know, the best school system I think is like Orange County, but we didn't quite work out. But the best one we could find was Alhambra, which is like South Pasadena. It was really
Pasadena is
nice.
Yeah, nice. This
area.
Is a quiet area, man.
Yeah,
I love it there. Pasadena was like apparently back in the day when Hollywood was sort of first created in the 20s or whatever. Mm-hmm. The stars would fucking booze it up and do blow in the Hollywood Hills, and the producers are like, let me get the fuck out of here. And then they set up shop in Pasadena. That's
that
why
makes
if
sense.
You go by Pasadena, there's these giant estates,
yeah,
these beautiful houses.
Man.
God,
gorgeous.
Some amazing houses in Pasadena.
Yeah.
I fucking love Pasadena.
Yeah, it's nice.
There's a gym. Isn't there like a Sityotong?
Yeah, Sityotong is in Pasadena.
Pasadena.
Yeah. It's a good kickboxing gym. They've been around for a long time. Muay Thai.
Yeah, LA is a weird spot where you would think there'd be a lot more like top level MMA gyms in this area than there are.
Yeah, there really is a, you know, there wasn't a whole lot. Like in Hollywood, it was like Legends was like the only MMA gym for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And then, yeah.
Well, Legends went under, and then, you know, you've got some stuff down in Orange County, of course. You got Reign, you got Kings, but,
Team Oyama.
Yeah, Team Oyama, but there's no like Jackson's MMA,
right,
where you got like world champions training in one facility,
right,
that's like this center spot. It almost seems like for a lot of places, like it might actually be better to be in a small town and bring the guys in.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you're going to have less distractions and less bullshit if that happens.
Right.
But LA doesn't have a lot of great kickboxing either. There's not a lot of different spots. I mean, many people as there are, 20 million people.
Yeah, when I moved out here from Ohio, it was to pursue kickboxing. It was because Los Angeles and California was the center for kickboxing in this country. You know, it was the only show, the only place. I mean, when I was moved out here when I was 19, they were the only ones putting on sanctioned Muay Thai fights. Was Dennis Warner and Vut Promotions, and but there's a really good gyms in
Van Nuys.
In Van Nuys, there's a really good gym in North Hollywood, two or three in North Hollywood. There's a Santa Clarita's got some really good gyms. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of Muay Thai here in Southern California, and I think that's, you know, when I was fighting it and amateurs and smokers and on the smaller shows here in California, it was the amateur was a very high level. You know, very high level, and I was 23 and one as an amateur, and most of those were smokers, just local amateur fights before I went pro.
There's so many jiu-jitsu schools here. That's what's ridiculous.
Jiu-jitsu's it's crazy here, right?
It's amazing when you compare jiu-jitsu to all the other martial arts. It's maybe like it's almost like 10 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
It's like how many jiu-jitsu gyms, and then world class, you know,
right.
Hickson's here, Crohn's here, mm-hmm. Jean-Jacques Machado's got two gyms here, Hegan's got a gym here. It's like on and on and on. You can keep going over and over and over. There's so many fucking world class jiu-jitsu schools here. Because Brazilians, they like the sun, they want to be near the
right.
beach, you know, it's like
yeah.
this is the spot they gravitate to.
You can't disagree with them.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing how much that's changed in this country. You know, when I first started training in 96, there was a small handful of black belts in the country. There was just not that many, like, world-class places to train. Now they're everywhere. Mm-hmm. Every city you go to, there's a legit black belt that's teaching classes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's places that have, you know, Henzo's got like 500-plus students in New York City. You know, New York City's another hotbed. It's like, you know, there's Henzo and Marcelo Garcia and, you know, on and on and on. You can just keep going. There's just so many gyms there. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to a place where you have, like, a legit world-class MMA training facility, like an AKA, mm-hmm. you know, there's still not that many of them.
Right.
You know, and especially when you look at California, you would think, man, you know, this is like so much kickboxing, so much jiu-jitsu, so much MMA, like, you know, or so much, you know, so many fighters,
right?
But not like one, like, it's a big central spot.
Mm-hmm. And then the ones that it's like almost like, you know, like Timo Yama's got like Ian and most of their team is a lot smaller. Mm-hmm. People, you know what I mean? Like, I was going there for a long time and I used to train with Shane Del Rosario before he passed away. And after he was gone, there wasn't a whole lot of guys my size down there, you know? So
that's an issue for bigger guys
it's a big
especially
issue.
For heavyweights. Yeah. It's really hard for heavyweights to find good training partners, mm-hmm. to find a skillful guy that's above 225 pounds. It's just, it's not that many.
Right. I think Alliance has got a good team down in San Diego, right?
They're pretty good. Guys. They got some good guys. You know, of course, AKA has Cormier and Kane. There's some good guys there.
Rockhold's been doing really well lately too.
Yeah, Rockhold's a beast.
Yeah.
This is an interesting time because people are still trying to figure out how to train correctly for MMA. You know, it's like you've got a lot of guys that are still holdovers from the early days where they would get together and try to figure it out and slug it out, and there was a lot of like unnecessarily hard sparring or unnecessarily hard not smart sparring. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, people are still trying to figure out, like, what's the best way to go about it. And then you have people that have figured it out, like the AKAs that have figured it out or the American Top Teams where they have it down to a science, you know. But there's just not that many. Whereas, like, if you look at any other major sport, look at baseball or football, like, they have protocols, like strength and conditioning protocols they put all their athletes through. And there's been programs because they go through from high school to college to the pros. Like, they know, like, state of the art, this is what we're supposed to do. Right. This is the best way to recover. This is the best way to train strength and conditioning. This is the best way to do this. With MMA, also, there's so many skills. There's so many things to learn. It's like, it's one of the most interesting things about MMA, but it's also one of the things like, man, what do you concentrate on?
That's a really good point. You know, with me transitioning over to MMA, that's one thing I'm really enjoying is there's so much. You know, I've done kickboxing for so long where, you know, I don't know everything there is to know about kickboxing, but I feel very at home. And if I get in good shape and my coaches are just sharpening me up and keeping me fresh, I feel like I can get in a kickboxing fight and just react naturally. You know, and with MMA, I'm still learning and still thinking about things. And a lot of times I remember what I was supposed to do like 10 seconds after, you know, I got tapped out. I should have done this or did that, you know. So, but it's a lot of fun to be evolving and keep learning new things for me, you know. And there's so much stuff to learn and so many different styles and different ways to win. And that's been really beneficial for me working with Nick and Nate is they think about it so analytically, you know, like, oh, you know, going on top, going on bottom, like, if this doesn't work out, then you're going to end up here. And, you know, it's really interesting.
Is it difficult? Because you're doing both. Mm-hmm. You just fought Melvin Manhoef in a big MMA fight in Bellator. Right. And then you're going from that. A couple months later, you're fighting in a big kickboxing event. Is it difficult to do both at the same time?
Well, I'm going to find out. you know, right now I'm living the dream. I feel like I can be really successful in both right now, depending on the right matchups. You know, I don't think I'm... You know, I don't think I'm a contender for a title in MMA just yet. You know, there's things I have to remember not to do for both. You know what I mean?
Right.
If I knock somebody down in MMA, I don't walk away and expect an eight count. You know,
unless you're Mark Hunt.
Yeah, you know,
he's the king of the walk away KO in MMA.
It was funny when I knocked out Melvin. I felt the walk away like I needed to do. I knew he was out, but. My coach and my manager were very adamant that the night of the fight and then like the week of that, like, this isn't kickboxing. There isn't going to be an eight count. If you drop him, make sure you go over him and finish him. You know, like, you need to finish right away. And so, like, I hit him with, like, the hook cross. I didn't even know I hit him with the left hand. I thought it was just the right hand until I saw the video. And I saw him go down, and, he's going down with his hands up. And I, like, wanted to walk away, and then, like, it was, like, this voice in my head, like, go finish him. And I went to go, and Mike Beltran had jumped in the way. And then I was just like, totally ruined my walk-off right now.
You could have just walked off. Right. Yeah. Pull that up, Jamie. Joe Schilling KOs Melvin Manhoef. That was a big fight for you because that guy, Melvin Manhoef, is his style is terrifying. Like, people are terrified of that guy because, first of all, he's black as coal. He looks like a fucking superhero. He comes out throwing bombs, knocked out Mark Hunt with one punch. I mean, he's a terrifying knockout
striker. And his highlight reel is like 12 minutes long. Everybody, like the week of the fight, everyone's like, Joe Schilling's fighting this guy, and they tag me in it. Like, every time I checked Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, it was like people reminding me that I'm fighting, you know, this guy, and it was just like knockout, 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 you know.
He's got the highlight reel of death.
Yeah, he's a... It was a really big fight for me. It was a really tough fight for me, too. You know, it was a really bad camp. It was probably the worst camp of my career. My dad had passed away, like, 3 weeks before the fight, and, like, 2 or 3 days after that.
Why does that look so shitty, Jamie?
My cousin passed away. So
it
was
like, pull it back. Is it our computer that's doing that?
Yeah. It's Drags because of the computer.
Why is it? But come on, man. This is fucking, it's a YouTube video. Is it really that bad? What do we got to do to fix that? Tell me whatever we have to do to fix that. Let's fucking fix that, because this is pissing me off. This looks like shit. Can't even see it. Boom! Damn. That dude's been flatlined a bunch of times over the last few years.
Yeah.
It's those Dutch guys. A lot of fucking tough guys in Holland, man. Mm-hmm. A lot of tough kickboxers in Holland.
It's like, I think I'm almost like a kamikaze fighter. It's either like kill or be killed, but that's why I'm a fan of him. You know, like, who doesn't want to watch a Melvin Manhoef fight? You know?
Yeah, no, I'm a huge fan. Mike's gym produces some goddamn savages. And Badr Hari's a goddamn savage too. What is he doing these days? Is he going to jail again, or what's happening?
I'm not sure what that situation is, but I think he's training for a fight. I think he's fighting in a global fighting championships in Russia or somewhere. No, I think
he's not fighting Glory.
I don't know.
Why doesn't Glory get that guy?
I asked myself the same question.
He's a fun heavyweight. Yeah, he's a fun heavyweight.
Yeah, he's one of my all-time favorites. Yeah,
that dude's a mad dog.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure he's going to pass any piss tests, but he's a mad dog.
Yeah.
A lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, the Dutch kickboxing scene is not one for piss tests. So.
Yeah, that's one good way of putting it.
I think America is the only country in the world that really drug tests their athletes, you know, especially with fighting. You know?
Really?
I don't think that there's any drug testing in, you know, well, in Japan there was definitely no drug testing.
Well, in Japan they drug test you to make sure you're doing steroids.
To make sure you're doing it.
Yeah. Make sure. I have a friend who is a natural. I mean, he should have been fighting 155, and he was going over to Japan, and they wanted him to fight 185. Yeah, they were like, you know, you're a big guy. Let's do some juice. Let's get you pumped up. And he was like, what? Like, he was used to dealing with American promoters, where they never said that to him. They sat him down. They flew him out there, sat him down, and they essentially told him to get on steroids.
What did he do?
He wound up fighting in America. But he went over there, you know, and had the meeting. He had one fight over there, and they liked him, but they wanted him to go up. I think he fought over there at 160. And they wanted him to fight 185. Like, what the fuck are you guys talking about?
I mean, it's one thing if you're like, you're a big guy already, and they're like, oh, we want you to go up in weight. It's another one, like, you're really good, but we want you to put on 20 pounds of muscle and fight.
Well, I think in Japan, they feel like the larger weight classes are the ones that sell the most.
Right.
And I think that was their thought process. He's a good-looking guy. They feel like this guy, put some big muscles on him, we're going to make some money, you know? They're definitely not thinking like, hey, for your career, this is the best move.
Right, or your safety.
Well, you hear those stories about the Yakuza back in the Pride Glory days giving you bowling ball bags filled with money. Yeah. And
I heard a few stories like that. They show up at your hotel room the night before the fight with like grocery bags full of money. You know?
When guys take them back with them, they would be taping rolls of money to their body.
Right, because you can only take $10,000 or something back.
So they'd be literally taping stacks of money to their body to try to get through security.
Like, Hoist had like every member of his entourage had to hold like $10,000 to go on the plane to come back.
After you fly over there, you know? But try explaining that. So you're traveling with this dude, and he's got 10 grand too. Mm-hmm. And this guy, what a coincidence. He's got 10 grand. How's this guy have 10 grand too? What did you guys fucking find some money over there? Like, what the hell happened in Japan?
Yeah. No taxes for that.
The glory days. That's a beautiful thing about this sport, though, that the glory days were only like a decade ago.
Right.
You know, it's like it's so young.
Right.
22 years since the UFC was first created. Yeah. It's hard to believe.
And that those guys in the glory day are still, you know, competing now. You know, a lot of them. You know.
So is your plan to this in glory days, you're fighting in glory. I would love it if glory became really successful because I'm a huge fan of kickboxing. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I mean, how successful was their pay-per-view venture?
The pay-per-view venture, I don't think it did very good at all. But I think it was more about a strategic thing. Like, if you give away your product for free all the time, then it's hard to ever establish, okay, now you have to pay for it. Mm. You know? So I think they did that as more of like they needed to do a pay-per-view. But their pay-per-view buys weren't that great, which I think was kind of unfortunate because that was like the end-all be-all for combat sports in one night. You know, if they could have put that on Spike TV, I think that would have done huge numbers for building their brand. But they had a great, you know, the other thing they did on that was they had two cards at one time. So you have, you know, Krokop was the main event on the card that was live on Spike TV. And I think it's just hard to get people. I mean, I love kickboxing, but I'm not going to watch it for an hour and a half and then pay another $60 to watch it for another hour and a half on the same night. You know,
right?
I think that was just.
Well, they tried the UFC strategy, the way the UFC has the prelims on Fox Sports 1 and they have the main bouts on pay-per-view afterwards. They tried that strategy. But the UFC is just way more established. I think it's really hard to do that with kickboxing because, for the most part, most of the people that are watching have no idea who anybody fighting is.
Right.
So you watch
except Joe Schilling.
Except Joe Schilling and whoever he fights.
Yeah.
But if you watch, you know, the UFC, they're prepping you for the big stars.
Right.
But they haven't really established glory enough to have big stars yet. But man, the level of kickboxing is so high.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of frustrating because, you know, for the what do you call them? Like the new fan, even for MMA, you know, you still get people like, oh, what's this boring stuff on the ground that don't appreciate the sport. Mm-hmm. They just want to see the action or whatnot. Like, those people need to tune in to kickboxing, you know.
Those people need to eat paint.
Right.
They all need to eat lead paint and go fuck themselves. It's just fans. That's the one thing that just disappoints me so bad when I go on Twitter. And I read, like, a fighter will post something, you know, after the fight, and you read all the people talking shit about them, and just like, oh, fucking Christ, man. Yeah. There are so many douchebags.
And it's kind of worse for MMA, you know. Obviously,
is it?
Yeah. Obviously, like, there was a lot more exposure from my fight with Melvin. You know, I always knew that there was a bigger fan base for MMA than there was for kickboxing, but I had no idea how much bigger it was. You know, when I won the Glory 10, I was the first American to ever win a global combat tournament ever. And it was like a huge deal. It was the biggest payday, I think, in American kickboxing history. And I think there was like 3 stories done on me about it total. And then my fight with Melvin was, you know, it wasn't for a title or for ranking. And, you know, it was just a one fight. And, you know, it's been all kinds of publicity and more following from that. But like within like 2 days, there was people on my Instagram like just writing the most degrading, disrespectful shit about like my family and my mom and my, you know, just ridiculous stuff. And then so, you know, you get more fans, you get more, you know, whack jobs, but there definitely seems to be a little bit more ignorant fans that hang out trashing people in MMA.
There's just so many dummies in this world that get to
period, right?
Yeah, and they have an outlet to reach you. Mm-hmm. Whereas before, you know, they would just be yelling at each other at the gas station, you know, mm-hmm. that guy ain't got no heart. He ain't got no heart. I kick his fucking ass. And that's where it would end.
Right.
But now these dummies,
now they can tweet directly at me.
They have an Instagram and they get on your page and you just leave these posts and you read them and you just go, fuck, man. Imagine if, you know, someone came from another planet and they were trying to understand what people were like and they read comments on Instagram.
Right.
They'd be like, well, we got to nuke this fucking thing.
Yeah.
Nuke this thing from orbit. It'd be like like that movie Aliens. We got to nuke it from orbit just to be sure. Like, these assholes, these guys have bombs and missiles and this is the way they think. You know, it's not indicative of the best example of humanity.
Yeah.
Especially combat sports. There's something about fighting. Well, kind of sports in general, man. I'm not a sports fan. I don't pay attention to football or baseball, but
I don't either.
every now and then I will read like comment sections on blogs just to see like if they're the same as like, and it's the same. It's the same shit.
What's that?
Yeah, you got busted trying to get a hooker. It's 7 in the morning. That's a desperado cocaine move. I test that motherfucker.
Immediately fired from ESPN.
Did they fire him?
Immediately fired from ESPN.
That's hilarious. That's hilarious. They should give him a raise.
Yeah.
At least he's not raping anybody.
Right.
He's trying to get a hook. He's trying to pay for it. Give the man a break. Look, it's
I think that's the worst possible. Like, what could be worse than that?
Prostitution?
Like, scandal-wise. No, like, getting caught picking up a prostitute. Like,
it shouldn't even be a big deal.
No?
Just the guy's trying to get a massage on his dick. That's all it is. I mean, look, if it's 7 o'clock in the morning, he was trying to get a massage, nobody would bat an eye. You're trying to get someone to touch you for money. That's right. What it is. But oh no, they're touching the bad spot, the naughty area. Yeah. Ooh, this is crazy. You know, if you had if you paid a woman to suck on the back of your neck, nobody would be like, okay, yeah, I paid her $1,000 to suck on the back of my neck. People would be like, okay, all right, we'll get that seems okay. We checked the rules. That's all right. But I paid her to suck my dick. What? Fuck it. What did you say?
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
You're fired.
It feels good?
No
shit.
Future.
What did I do wrong? I don't know. She needed $1,000. I needed a blowjob. who got hurt here?
Yeah.
I'm so fucking confused. Well, the sponsors.
Yeah.
The sponsors won't tolerate it, Joe Schilling. We need to sell Gatorade. We're not selling blowjobs. It's fucking ridiculous.
It is fucking ridiculous.
We live in a goofy, goofy baby world. This is an infantile world. Guy gets arrested for fucking soliciting prostitution. Did he hit up a cop or something?
I don't know. I hadn't heard that whole story. I was hoping you knew.
Do you know what happened, Jamie? You should know. You're the gossip monger.
He admitted to, I guess the girls said that he was assaulting them. Two girls.
Oh.
And then when the cops came for that, he admitted to the solicitation of prostitution, but not the assault.
Oh, so he's a douchebag. All right, I take it back. Yeah, see, you know what, man? If there was like a legit establishment where he could go to and just give them money, and it's just, to me, look, I have daughters, and the last thing I would ever want is my daughters to be prostitutes. However, I believe that part of our issue that we have as human beings with prostitution is just this weird Puritan view of sex, that sex is somehow or another this forbidden evil thing. It's just two people touching each other's bodies. Mm-hmm. No babies are getting eaten. You know, no fucking slaves are getting whipped. No one's getting tossed off cliffs. This is not a horrible thing. It's fine if you do it for free, right? No one has any problem if you have sex for free. Right. The idea that if you give someone money and you have sex, all of a sudden it's this terrible, awful, evil thing, I think that's stupid. I think it's stupid and it's archaic. And this world that we live in is changing, and people are starting to realize that adult human being. Look, you got a fucking 100 years on this planet, if you're lucky. That's it. It's just this wild ride of good times and hopefully friends and good food and wonderful life experiences. And who the fuck is anybody to tell you that paying for sex or someone paying you for sex is bad? I mean, who is that? Who are those people? Well, they're the same assholes that tell you you shouldn't pay for weed. You shouldn't be able to smoke weed.
Right.
The same assholes that tell you you shouldn't be able to do psychedelics or you shouldn't be able to whatever the fuck it is. If it's not hurting anybody.
It's the Nancy Graces of the world.
That's it. That's it.
Did you see her interview with
2 Chainz?
Oh, my God. I was so like.
First of all, someone stole one of 2 Chainz's chains because he only had one chain on. I was confused.
Really?
The whole video. I was like, where's the other chain? Motherfucker's got one chain. You can't call yourself 2 Chainz and have a fucking debate on CNN, sir. You need to use your goddamn birth name, all right? I need to see a fucking birth certificate and a driver's license. 2 Chainz. 2 Chainz. You know, my name's not Joe Schilling. It's Crazy Donkey.
Yeah.
You know? what would your rap name be?
What would my rap name be? I don't know.
Would it just be, this is Can't Stop Crazy?
I guess so. This Can't Stop Crazy.
Where did that slogan, Can't Stop Crazy, come from?
That actually came from, I think it was my second pro Muay Thai fight. I just kind of went berserk and with elbows and knees. And one of the guys that trained in my gym was like, oh, you know, you can't stop crazy. And I just remember thinking that was like the dumbest thing I'd ever heard at the time.
Dude.
And then, later on, it was a time when, before Glory, before Lion Fight got a TV deal, there was kickboxing and all the shows that I was fighting on, the fans didn't really have any connection to any one of the fighters unless you went to every show. So there was, it was really hard to set yourself apart as, you know, the high level guy or the better guy, like who was really doing it, you know, because there was no media involved. And me and like the other five or six best kickboxers in the United States got together and started like our own website and started promoting ourselves. And we hired, got our, the best photographers in the sport and kind of just built our own media for ourselves. And, you know, eventually Lion Fight got a TV deal and, you know, Glory came. But for a long time, it was just us kind of making it for ourselves. And we were like, what do we call it? And it was like, oh, Can't Stop Crazy. Okay, that's cool. It's kind of a movement. It really kind of took off. It's weird. I can't even describe what it is now. People always ask me to describe it. It's just a group of people that we sell T-shirts and we used to do our own interviews and with no TV backing. You know, there was nobody promoting us. You know,
and these are the shirts right here.
Yeah, nice some of them.
See, you can wear this. This is 100% douche free. No one would have any idea. Note the lack of skulls.
Yep.
There's no swords going through a broken skull with a snake wrapped around it. There's no pit bulls getting fucked in the ass by a dragon.
Actually, Drew, if you're listening, our designer, I would like a shirt made with a pit bull getting fucked in the ass by a dragon.
In glitter,
and that's going to be the Joe Rogan shirt.
Some Japanese foil writing behind it.
Yeah, there you go.
You know? Yeah, I don't know, man. The world of MMA t-shirts.
Ed Hardy dropped off pretty quick. Remember, that was like...
I wonder why. Ed Hardy was like... It was like it was like Von Dutch for people with head injuries.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, people like, Von Dutch is just fucking too clever for me.
I mean, do you think, what do you think really started that downfall for them? Was it the Hulk Hogan show where he wore... Hulk Hogan was like their poster boy for it, and then they kind of...
I think it's just overexposure. Yeah. Anytime things get... I mean, people love those old school Americana tattoos, which to me, that's what Ed Hardy always used to represent. Right. Like, it was kind of cool, those old, like, sailor tattoos. Like, those, I like those.
And then they bedazzled the shit out of it.
Right? Yeah, then it was like, what is going on here? Yeah. And then it became this weird... It was like a Von Dutch thing. Like, yeah. Von Dutch used to be the fucking shit. Ashton Kutcher used to wear those stupid trucker hats, and everybody was like, man, I gotta get one.
Yeah.
And I would look at it, I was like, what the fuck are you wearing, man? Yeah. That looks like you're wearing, like, some diner in, like, Cincinnati. They have, like, a hat that they sell. You know, that's what it looked like. You know what I mean? Like, it's just some obscure, like, truck stop diner.
You're right.
You know, and then all of a sudden all these people are wearing it like, you know, I'm going to tilt it to the side. I'm crazy. It's just, I don't know what happened, but it became this thing that douchebags would wear. I don't know. I don't know how it happened.
Yeah.
But it went, it came, and everybody, you know what it was like? It's like the spinning wheels of clothing. Remember those spinners that people used to have on the rims? They lasted a little while where people were like, what the fuck are we doing?
Yeah.
And those spinners killed the custom wheel market because it used to be everybody would get a car and then they would get custom wheels. Like, you could take like a pretty decent car but put some sweet wheels on it and everybody like, that's a pretty nice car. But those fucking spinners came out and everybody's like, that's it, we're going the other way.
Yep.
Don't ever change your wheels. Just leave the fucking wheels the car came with.
Yeah.
Like, this is ridiculous. We can't be associated with this. You notice that?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a... Yeah, now it's like they're like painted wheels or like stand like...
Low key.
Giant, yeah, low key. You know, you might have nice wheels, but they're like painted black and match your car. Or whatever.
Yeah, that's okay.
They're not like giant gold spinning, you know. And then they had like 28s or something that came out where
Jesus
it was like
Christ.
They took the wheel and then they would like make the lip of the wheel even bigger so it looked like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, they had tires that were like literally the thickness of an iPhone. You know, that was what was like your tire.
And then they put it on like a old Monte Carlo. Now it's like a Monte Carlo monster truck, you know.
That's a common thing, right?
Yeah.
Those Impalas.
Yeah.
They would put it on these ridiculous cars. They have like wagon wheels.
Yeah.
They were like, they were the most preposterous wheels ever. And those things break all the time. You go over a bump, hit a pothole. There's no tire. There's it's like you're running around on metal rims. They bend.
Yeah, I put 20-inch wheels on my Acura, and they're not like flashy. They're like paint black wheels or whatever. But I either had to roll the fenders, which I didn't realize when I bought the car. But either
what kind of Acura you got?
It's a TL. Nothing spectacular. But it's when I got the wheels, I I didn't know that you couldn't fit 20. I just wanted to.
They rubbed.
You know, they would rub unless you rolled the fenders. So I got, when I ordered it, they were like, "Oh, you need to get these 35s or 30 tires." And I'm like, whatever. I didn't know what it was. Apparently, a 30 tire is like this big.
Very thin.
It's incredibly thin. And, you know, it looks cool, but I'm constantly, every time I drive up north, I get a flat tire. Like, all the time. I've had to repair the rims like 3 or 4 times just because the tire gets so low. Ugh. And you hit a bump and it puts a hole in the, or bends or cracks the rim.
Yeah, it's a pain in the ass. It's go back to standard.
Yeah, I'm just going to go put my stock wheels back on.
Yeah, put the stock wheels back on. Acura makes a fucking hell of a car, though. They're an underappreciated car.
Yeah, they really are. I love it.
I had 2 NSXs. I still might go out and buy an old one.
I'm looking for one.
Actually. Those fucking cars are great, man. I love that car. Never had a problem.
Yeah.
Every time you go to start, starts right up. Yeah. Now, Honda's just... You can't fuck with Toyotas and Hondas. Mm-hmm. Those motherfuckers will run forever.
I had a Honda Accord when I was in high school. It was like a 92 Honda Accord. And I never changed the oil in the thing. Like, you know, I had no money. I drove around with $2 worth of gas all the time. Like, you know, never changed the tire. And I think I ended up having 2 clutches. I went through 2 clutches because I was like Fast and Furious. The movie had come out back then. So it was like burnouts at every like stoplight. Man, I did a lot of dumb shit with that car. You know those Whippet things where you can, it's like a, I think it's the actual use for it is to be like a whipped cream
maker. Yeah.
But you can, it's like a canister and you can put a little Whippet cartridge in it and it'll, and you hit the button, it'll fill up and you can fill up your balloon off of that.
Right.
So I think it was like 16 or 17. I had wired, like put a tube through my, through my glove box all the way into my intake in the front. And I was like, you know, a little street racer guy. And I would crack off like 4 or 5 Whippets in that little container and thought I had nitrous in my car through my glove box. True story. But that Honda, I ended up giving it to a friend when I got another car. And he drove it literally till the wheel fell off, till the front wheel fell off. It had like over 325,000 miles on it. And I think he just ran until the wheel fell off.
Japanese make amazing cars. I have a friend who has a Lexus that has 1 million miles on it.
Really?
1 million. Yeah, it's like, it's a famous car. Like, I don't know if it's his. He's Matt Farah from the Smoking Tire. He always has images of it. He brings it everywhere, just puts it online. It's got 1 million fucking miles on it.
Amazing.
1 million. They just don't break. It's like something happened along the way where it became acceptable for cars to just fuck up.
Yeah, to just be a piece of shit.
Yeah.
And it's American cars. Why do we do that to ourselves? You know?
It's not just American cars.
It's like it's always the Japanese cars that last forever.
Yeah. You know?
The Lexus, the Toyota, the Honda.
Even German cars, which are amazing. Like I had cars that have problems.
That's a piece of shit.
They fuck up. I know someone who has a Porsche Cayenne, and she went to start it the other day. Catastrophic fucking failure. Just engine lights on. Year-old car. It's probably like, what, a fucking 160 grand or something like that, Cayenne turbo.
Wow.
Pressing buttons, all these lights are going on. Like, what's going on here? Nothing. Got to tow it. Get it towed. They're like, oh, well, there's a problem wrong with your thing, and they replace the thing, and like, what? Like, what if you were in Alaska and that shit went wrong? Yeah. Like, what if you're driving across country?
Yeah, you know, when you're driving your Porsche in Alaska.
You never know.
Well, I guess there are people in Alaska that have Porsches.
There must be people in Alaska who've got some cheese.
Yeah.
Want to fucking be a baller out there and drive under moose with a fucking Cayenne? Yeah, something about those Japanese cars, though. They, for whatever reason, it's like the Japanese culture itself. Have you fought in Japan?
I haven't.
I would think that that's like, especially for a kickboxer, when it comes down to like the K1 glory days, those are probably the glory days of, not necessarily of Muay Thai, because, you know, there's a lot of like, the great Muay Thai fighters, particularly like in the lower weight classes, mm-hmm. came out of Thailand.
Yeah.
But as far as like heavyweights and the larger kickboxing bouts, like, man, it all took place in Japan.
Yeah, I mean, that's where when I moved out here when I was 19, I was going to school, and then I couldn't afford cable. I had a little job as like a room service attendant at the Bonaventure Hotel, but I would go to this video store in Little Tokyo, and they sold all the K1 videotapes, and that was, I remember my girlfriend coming over and just being like, can we watch something else? And it was all the time, K1 Max or K1 Heavyweights, and yeah, I mean, that was the best. Like the 100-foot giant screens, you know, the long walkways, the wars they had in K1. I mean, that was the golden era of
the pageantry.
And which is what Glory is now, you know. So I wish
I wish the
fans that loved K1 would pay attention to Glory.
Well, I just think,
I hate for this thing to fail, you know. It's been so long that we were trying to get this sport going, and you know, nobody's going to watch a Glory show and not fall in love with it. You know what I mean?
It's just, I agree.
Turn on the damn channel.
You know, I told the UFC, you know, maybe like 7 or 8 years ago, I told them to buy a K1 because I heard the K1 was for sale. I said, you guys should buy K1.
Did you know the Ultimate Fighter was originally supposed to be the K1?
Really? What do you mean?
Mike Kogan, my manager, told me this. He used to work with K1 and when K1 USA with Scott Coker, that the Ultimate Fighter TV show was originally supposed to be K1 on Spike, and the deal didn't go through or something, and then Dana and the Fertittas picked it up and did the UFC for it.
Wow.
But originally it was supposed to be K1.
I would double check on that if it's coming from Mike Hogan.
Yeah.
But
that's what he said.
You never know. He might be right.
Joe Schilling is the most gullible motherfucker.
But I think that the level's there, you know, like here, like, the big fight, Rico Verhoeven, he's like, you know, like one of the best kickboxers. Mm-hmm. You could put him back in the K1 Glory days.
Yeah, I mean, he fought right Peter Ernst. He's fought a lot of those big name guys.
Oh, yeah. I mean, sure. Like, think about the guys that they have. I mean, there's a wealth of talent in kickboxing, especially like a lot of these European guys, a lot of these guys from Holland. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many good fighters. It's not a lack of talent. It's one of those things where it's like, at this point, it's almost like it just needs time. Mm-hmm. It's almost like it just needs – it's like if they're willing to do what the UFC did and put that – put the show on and, you know – I mean,
waited,
look.
Wait it out.
Yeah. Daniel Gita, I mean, Gokhan Saki. I mean, there's some fucking great fighters. You guys have Karatanov now too.
Yeah.
Some really exciting fighters in the heavyweight division as well as all the other divisions. But if they just take the time, like the UFC was $44 million in the hole before the Ultimate Fighter got on the air.
Really?
And they were ready to pull the plug.
Yeah.
They'd even, there was one point in time where Dana had had a conversation with Lorenzo and they were like, look, we can't keep hemorrhaging money. Let's just sell it. Let's just get rid of this. Let's see what we can get for it. And they were going to sell it at a big loss. And the next day, like Lorenzo slept on it and got up and fucking changed his mind. He said, fuck it. Guns blazing. Let's keep going. Let's ride this bitch out. Which is what you can do when you're a billionaire.
Yeah. Well, I think that's probably not real far from where you know the Glory story is right now. You know, we have Pierre, the owner of Glory, and the head chairman or whatever, is definitely the one funding 90% of this stuff and pushing that. So, you know, thank you, Pierre. Please keep it up. You know, we're almost there. You know, we're almost there.
Look, it's so the product is there. See, that's the thing. It's like the product is there. The fights are there. Anybody who watches that, the event that you were in, the Last Man Standing event, that fucking shit is on my DVR for life. Which, by the way, it cut out before the end somehow or another.
Really?
I don't know what the fuck happened. Maybe I only recorded it for 3 hours or something like a retard. But anybody who watches that tournament or doesn't get hooked on Glory and hooked on kickboxing, you got no pulse.
And that's the other thing about it Glory is doing, which I don't know any of the finance stuff about it, but they're not going cheap on any of it. You know what
right.
I mean? Like there is a huge event. The production is insane. The fighters are insane. I mean, all of it is just really top notch. Really.
And you guys got Mike Tyson pimping for it now?
Yeah, apparently they got Mike Tyson doing this thing now for it, which is it's cool.
Yeah, if you go to the Glory page, go to gloryworldseries.com, Mike Tyson is doing the intro video, which is pretty fucking badass.
Yeah.
And is Rico Verhoeven versus Errol Zimmerman, and then there's you versus this kid is only 20 years old, huh?
Yeah, I think he's 22.
Robert Thomas from Canada.
Thomas.
Is he 22?
Yeah, they call him the White Dragon, Jim.
He's good. He's a good fighter. It's going to be interesting.
Yep.
Have you seen him fight before?
Yeah, I saw a couple fights online. He fought Artem Levin. And, then he fought Alex Pereira, who's another guy in the top 10 in Brazil. He came up short on both of those, but, you know, I have a lot of respect for somebody that's that young in his career and is going after the top fights. I mean, that was me. I was the guy that wanted those tough shots, so I know how dangerous those kind of people can be.
Yeah, his last fight in Glory was Glory 18 in November. He KO'd Mike Lemaire.
Mm-hmm.
So this is going to be fun, man. I just love the fact, like I said, that they're doing this. And Nicky Holson is fighting too, who's a fuck. He's so high level.
Dude, he's really fun to watch.
He's so really, fun
really
to watch.
Good, really good fighter.
So technical, yeah. Man. Everything he does, just that classic Muay Thai, you know, the classic kickboxing style from Holland. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just,
and his boxing is like phenomenal. He's been going back and forth doing professional boxing over there between fights, and yeah, his hands are really good. He's my pick to win the tournament. But then they also got Raymond Daniels, who's mm-hmm. a human highlight reel. You know, he's a really high-level martial artist. I don't know if I'd really call him a kickboxer.
Well, he's becoming a kickboxer, right, but he's really like a karate guy who's getting into MMA, who's getting into kickboxing, rather. But the shit that he does, like that touch, jumping sidekick, spinning back kick in the air that he KO'd his last opponent with,
I couldn't do that on the bag. Like, I don't know how he does that. And then, like, the timing of it. It's really, really, it's really... It's something else.
Yeah, he's learning the kickboxing game. He's still got like some gaps in his striking. Right. You see especially the transitions between kicking and punching.
Right.
But the stuff that he can do, you know, and he's still fairly young. I mean, he can still learn it. He's an LA guy too, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so.
Do you ever train with him?
I sparred with him once, probably 6 years ago, I think, when they had that World Combat League when Chuck Norris tried his little thing.
Oh, yeah.
That thing was so geared for his type of style, the point karate guys. Like, none of the Muay Thai guys did very well in that.
Well, that World Combat League, did they allow leg kicks?
They allowed leg kicks, but underneath those pants we had thick shin pads on. Like,
oh,
thick
really?
Shin pads. And then it was only 1 3-minute round.
They made you wear shin pads?
Yeah.
Huh.
And there was 1 3-minute round, and it's really hard to really make leg kicks that effective and 3 minutes with giant shin pads on. You know what I mean?
That seems ridiculous.
It was, well, Chuck Norris was his league, and it was really geared around, like, the point karate guys and that type of style.
You know what I found really interesting about it, though? It was the lack of ring. I really kind of like that. And I'm not sure if the slope...
For the
viewer. Yeah, if you don't know what I'm talking about, it was almost like a very shallow swimming pool, mm-hmm. where it's like it was flat in the bottom, and then for folks who didn't watch it, the edges were kind of sloped up, but not a big slope, just a slight slope, just enough to let you know that you're at the edge,
right.
And then they would bring everybody back to the center. It wasn't a very big thing, but I think that for MMA in particular, one of the things that drives people crazy is people being pressed up against the cage. Like, a lot of people don't like that aspect of MMA, like the clinching up against the cage and throwing knees to the leg. And, you know, they start booing and they want everybody to separate. I've always felt that, like, if a football game can be played in a fucking giant 100-yard field, mm-hmm. and a basketball game can be played in this, you know, really long court, why can't an MMA fight take place on a flat, like, just big, round, flat area like that where you don't have a ring? And there's, like, there's a red zone where you're out of bounds, you know, and make that red zone, you know, whatever, to fucking 5 yards or something like that, and then bring everybody back to the center. Well, you don't have any of that. If you're going to get a takedown, you got to get an honest fucking takedown like you do in a wrestling match.
Right.
Not pushing a guy up against the cage and pulling his legs out from right. under him, but an actual legit takedown.
Like, even in Pride, it was a lot harder to get a takedown.
Oh, yeah.
Because you couldn't pull, you know, because what they do is they'll shove you up against the fence and then they suck your legs out, you know, or get... to use that certain thing. I mean, I have a lot more, I'm a lot more comfortable defending takedowns in the middle, you know, stop, like, sprawl.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot easier to stop a takedown. Once they start smashing you against the cage, then there's a lot of different variables. And yeah, how many fights, like Tim Sylvia, I think it was Tim Sylvia and Brandon Vera, where they spent like 3 rounds just smashed against the side of the cage the whole time.
It happens.
You
know?
Yeah.
It happens a lot, and people get crazy. They boo, and they, you know, and it's also hard to see through a cage. Like,
right.
If you're standing in the crowd, even if you're on the floor, if, you know, you're a couple rows back and there's a pillar and they're behind that pillar and they're fighting, you can't see shit. You wind up looking up at the big screen.
That's what I was curious. Maybe you could tell me about this. When they're the UFC judges, do they have a screen in front of them
they
to watch?
They do now.
Okay.
This is something that we had to complain about for a long time.
Because
to
if
give
you're
them
sitting
screens.
There and the whole fight is going on the opposite side of the cage, mm-hmm. and you can't tell what's being landed or what, you know, just, you know,
well,
they're throwing punches, and like a lot of those punches that Anderson was throwing on Nick, he did a mm-hmm. really good job of blocking him. But if I'm 30 feet away, I can't tell if it landed or not.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's really hard to tell for while we're doing commentary. Like, sometimes I have to watch a replay to see if something landed. Mm-hmm. Like, if a guy's got his back to you and you see someone throw a punch and the guy falls down, you're like, oh, he got hit. But then you watch and you go, oh, no. He stepped on his foot and he slipped mm-hmm. and then he went down. Like, sometimes it'll look like a guy got hit. Sometimes it's better to watch it at home, really, right. than it is to watch it live.
Yeah.
You watch it at home, you're going to get the perfect angle. You know, the UFC broadcast team, those guys who are the production guys, they're the best.
Yeah.
I mean, they're so good at catching all the right angles. The replays are always on point. They know exactly what they're doing.
Right.
So you could almost see it better from home than you can. But there's a lot of people that complain, that like sit in the crowd, they're like, I can't fucking see. And they wind up like, you see, yeah. like look out in the crowd, they're looking up at the giant screen.
I've went to quite a few UFC fights where I was just, you know, I feel like you go there for the energy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're there for the energy of the crowd, but like you're watching a screen, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's an event. I mean, there's nothing like it. Like when you're watching like Nick versus Anderson. Like when they were about to fight and you know, and they're in the center of the cage and you know, the referee's reading them the instructions and then they back up and you're like, "Holy shit. It's happening right there." Yeah. It's fucking 30 feet away.
Yeah.
It's about to go down. There's nothing like that. That's some goosebump inducing shit.
And then he lays down, you're like, holy shit.
When he laid down and put his hands on his head like he's taking a nap.
Or picking his wedge and like, twerked at him a little bit.
Oh, dude, man. I was crying laughing.
Must see TV.
I was pounding on the table and crying laughing. I couldn't help myself. It just was so funny.
It was so good.
I had wondered, too, whether or not Nick was going to clown him. Because all the stuff leading up to the fight was totally respectful. All the stuff leading up to the fight was like, hey, you know, Nick was saying, I want big names. I want a big name fight. This is a big name fight.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I respect him and we're ready to go. And then when he got to the octagon, immediately he's talking shit.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see Anderson was just so not comfortable being the guy that gets shit talked to.
And I was telling him, keep talking. Like, I said fucking with him, but like, keep fucking with him. It's working.
Yeah.
Because when Nick stopped fucking with him in the later rounds, Anderson started doing a lot better, you know?
Mm.
I think
no doubt.
It was definitely, you know, the mind game and the, I think it was a really good strategy that he did come out through that. And he said in the back that it was going to do something like that. I had no idea he was going to lay down and put his hands like that.
Well, he probably didn't even know before he did that.
I think he just knew, like, if he doesn't want to engage, when, you know, I think he said, I'm going to flip that switch. I didn't realize that was the switch he was talking about, but God, was it awesome. And really, like, it's hard. Like, you know, there's an article just came out and said it was called the sober replay, or like the sober thought, like when you watch a fight after, you know, like the next day or whatever. And when we were in the corner, you know, we're yelling instructions, but between Gilbert and Nate Diaz and Cesar Gracie and I, all of us were just sitting there like, this guy's such a fucking beast. Like, we were so, like, blown away by what he was doing.
Mm.
We were just so impressed, and, you know, I was really proud of him.
Especially first time fighting at 185, too. He steps up and fights the greatest ever at 185.
After a two-year layoff.
Yeah, you know? Two-year layoff where he's not, you know, just really not pursuing any fights at all.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, made a shitload of money off the George St. Pierre fight and just laid back and relaxed for a little bit. And just said he wanted a big fight.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he had said before, he goes, I want a title shot. And they're like, well, we can't really just give you a title shot. Mm-hmm. Like, you got to beat somebody.
Right.
You know, and this was an opportunity to fight, you know, a guy who, it's just like getting a title shot. I mean, five-round fight for with sure. Anderson.
And then to do so well, I mean, the judges' scorecards, they gave all five rounds to Anderson, but every one of those rounds were very competitive, except the fourth. I think Nick took off the fourth round, but every one of those rounds I thought was really competitive and really close.
He was competitive enough, and especially if you consider the other fights that Anderson has been
right.
in.
Right. I think that's probably also, you know, they say, like, you have to beat the champion, you know, mm-hmm. so to speak. I felt like you have to really beat this underdog, and I didn't feel like Anderson did it that much. You know what I mean? Like,
well,
he really didn't whoop Nick's ass.
He won. I feel like he won,
but
I feel like he played it safe as fuck.
Right.
You know, I mean, he threw some wild shit. He threw a wheel kick at one point in time, but mm-hmm. there was no moment in time where he was treating Nick the way Nick treated him.
Right.
You know, where he was like, come on, bitch, like, let's do this. You know, like, mm-hmm. stood in front of him. He just wasn't ready for that. I mean, the psychological aspect also of having a guy like Nick taunt you, if Nick knocked him out, like what if he was taunting him and then all of a sudden, boom, Nick catches him and he's down, like that would just be devastating. And he just was not prepared for that.
Or Nick lays on the ground and he jumps into, you know,
Nick's guard, Nick's triangle.
And then Nick triangles him.
Yeah. Look, anything can fucking happen in MMA. Yeah. And a guy like Anderson knows it as much as anybody now, mm-hmm. especially after it happened to him.
Right.
I think also, too, the pressure of competing at that high level and being the champ for as long as Anderson was. Like, I remember when BJ Penn beat Matt Hughes, and I talked to Matt Hughes after it was over, and he was really honest about it. In the cage, he said, honestly, it's a relief. Like, being the champion is a lot of fucking stress. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't swear, but he was like, it's a relief. You know, I'm glad I got this weight lifted off my back, and I'm going to go back and relax and see what's up. You
That's
know?
Kind of the impression I got from George when I'm – was talking to George.
Yeah,
the same way. It's a ton of pressure to be the champion and for that long. And then everybody wants you. Everybody calls you out. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to fight you. Everybody attacks your character. It's got to get pretty old. And Nick was talking about that the other day in his post fight interview. He's like, you know, I kind of wish I fell off and people would stop talking about me. You know.
Well, he's such an enigma. You know, there's no one like Nick Diaz. He's there such really an isn't. Unusual character.
He's,
you know?
He really is. Yeah. I mean, I'm good friends with him, and I really have no fucking idea what's going on in his head 90% of the time, which actually makes it really fun sometimes. You know.
How often are you training with him?
I was training with him a lot for the Melvin fight until my dad died. I left his pad to go do the funeral and all that stuff. But yeah, I'm go up there pretty regularly.
And when Nick is in between camps, is he training on a regular basis? Does he still do everything, or is he just relaxing? Like, what has he been doing like over the 2 years?
Yeah, when I was had the Last Man Standing tournament, you know, that was back in June or July. I don't think he had booked the Anderson fight yet. He still was running with me, and I mean, I'm training for the hardest fight of my life. I run 6.5 miles. And he's pushing me, like I'm trying to keep up with him.
Wow. Know?
He runs at a ridiculous pace. He runs at an insane pace.
Does that fuck with your explosion at all? Like there's some people that believe that all that slow running and slow twitch endurance type work, mm-hmm. that it can actually fuck with your explosion.
Nick's going to disagree with me, but I think it does. I think that him, Nick and Nate both are not the most like explosive people when it comes to like their movement patterns or whatever. I feel like with me doing more, I do a lot more sprint work than I do long distance kind of stuff. But also like that's more of their style. They're very technical with their stuff. They don't use a lot of strength, and they both of them will wear you out and then whoop your ass afterwards.
Right.
So both of them have beat the piss out of me from just being durable as shit, and I'm throwing and throwing and throwing and throwing and throwing, and I'm like, tired, and then they say, "But motherfucker, yeah." And they start talking shit.
Once you're tired, they start talking
shit.
Yeah,
well, just the whole time, you know.
The whole time you're sparring with me, talk shit. Like, what's he saying?
You know, I don't know. Come on, shit like that. Nate, when for this last fight we were sparring, and Nick did. I think it was when the UFC was filming it. Nick had done like 9 5-minute rounds with fresh guys. It was like me, Chidi, and Jaquani had brought in to spar with him, and then another guy. And, like, the last round, I could tell that like, he was tired. And I was kind of, like, clenching me up against the fence and was, like, holding or whatever. And I'm like, come on, Nick, let's go. Like, trying to, like, motivate him. And he's like, fuck you, motherfucker. And, like, started to whoop my ass. Like, but, like, you know, the other thing about with Nick has mentioned is, like, sometimes it's a lot better, which I agree with. It's a lot better sometimes to spar with people you don't know instead of, like, your buddy. You know, you go a little harder or you're a little more competitive with somebody you don't know. And, like, when Nick and I first started, I mean, he used to be a lot more competitive with me, and then now we're pretty good friends. So I find myself like talking shit to him or trying to piss him off or hit him hard to get him to push a little harder.
That's interesting. So it replicates an actual competition more in that way than it does like light sparring with your friends.
Right. I mean, I think there's different times, different stuff, you know, like I'm at the point now where I don't feel like I don't have to win in sparring. I can work on other things. I can work on my defense. I'll work on stuff. Whereas I used to be like, I have to win in sparring. If I lost a round in sparring, I was really upset about it. But like Nick, how do I say this? Like with Nick, sometimes he'll coast or with this camp, he was coasting in some of the rounds. Or if I put him in there with somebody that wasn't that hard, he would like not do so well, and we just kind of go at the level of the person he was going with. So I found it you know, I would tell the people to hit him a lot fucking harder, almost try to piss him off, talk shit to him. You know?
Right.
I tried my best, like Anderson Silva, come on, like impressions with when we were sparring.
His kicking was a lot better in this fight than we'd ever seen it before.
Was
that,
it,
is that
Joe?
All you?
You know, there's a lot of people, some interview guy, I forget who it was, but he was like, you know, how do you feel about this fight with Nick? You know, looking at Nate's last performance, you know, blah, blah, blah. I was trying to compare, like, Nate versus Nick. Like, well, if Nate didn't do so good against Dos Anjos, then, you know, Nate. And I'm like, how the fuck?
That's MMA math.
It's two fucking completely different people.
Yeah. You know? Like, two different opponents, two different people, two different weight classes.
But, yeah, a lot of times when people have complained that both of them don't block kicks very well, and their understanding of kickboxing is a little different. So, like, for me as a coach, so to speak, in this camp, I was trying to bring in the best possible sparring partners I could for them. So I brought in Artem Levin. I brought in Chidi Njiquani. He was sparring with me. I believe, and I got a lot of flack for this, I believe all three of those people are better kickboxers than Anderson Silva. Being that they're kickboxers and Anderson Silva is an MMA fighter. So
right.
It's not a knock on Anderson Silva. I just think that those are very high level.
Well, it's just a reality.
It's a reality. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, Anderson has had spectacular striking moments in MMA.
Right.
But when it comes to his actual real-world kickboxing experience, it's fairly limited. He's had nearly as many fights, especially in, like, world-class competition.
Mm-hmm. But it was like, you know, Artem has a very, like, confident, like, head movement.
He's like a cobra.
He's very elusive.
Very sneaky,
that
guy.
Which is similar traits that Anderson has, but at a higher level.
Mm-hmm.
I think I hit a lot harder than Anderson, and I'm a little more aggressive, and, you know, whatever. Things that I do well translated well and Nick, for as far as the looks and the feelings. And then with Chidi Njiquani, he's got phenomenal movement. He looks similar to Anderson. He's got like 4-inch longer reach than Anderson, but he has a very, very similar movement patterns and the things that he does. So my thing was, you know, and Nick didn't necessarily beat any of us in any of that, you know what I mean? But he got used to seeing those situations so that when it happened, when Anderson threw that spinning heel kick, Nick was prepared for it, moved out of the way. Most of the kicks he blocked, you know, Nick threw a lot more kicks than he usually does. So his awareness of kickboxing, it showed, you know, and that was... You know, I didn't know how the fight was going to go, but I knew that I felt a lot of responsibility as far as if Nick got caught with something, some kick or some kickboxing move, I felt like I was going to be my fault, but I didn't show him. You know?
Now, were you holding pads with him?
I was holding pads for him, too.
So you were working on his combinations. Like, that left leg kick was big. That was more. He landed more leg kicks on Anderson than anybody had ever done before. Mm-hmm. If you go back and watch Anderson's fights, nobody landed like that. That left leg kick over and over again, he landed that. And I don't think Anderson expected that.
Right.
You know, Anderson stands southpaw, so that right leg's exposed. And Nick landed that left leg kick over and over again.
Yeah, there was something that we'd worked on, was just him throwing kicks and being more comfortable with kicks. I've always tried to get him to kick more, but it was something where he's a lot more confident with his hands. He's had more experience with his hands. And then sometimes if you don't kick enough, someone's forcing you kick all the time in the gym, you get tired when you throw a kick. You know, if I'm used to boxing all the time and I throw one or two kicks, it's like going for a takedown. I'm tired.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make sure that he felt good. You know, we worked on some elbows from the clinch. I thought he did really well against Anderson in the clinch, especially if you look at, like, how Rich Franklin did. So, you know, my goal wasn't to make Nick a high-level kickboxer. It was just to make him his awareness of kickboxing and his defense, you know. And I think it showed that he showed a lot. You know, he did
no, well. It definitely did. Now, does Nick do any weightlifting? Does he do any strength and conditioning stuff?
For this fight, he did. But again, it's not. It wasn't that heavy. But he worked his way up, and he did start weightlifting for that. And I think he put on. You know, he still was like right around 200 when he was walking around for the fight. You know, he was by no means like 205 or 210.
That's still heavy for him.
Might have hit 205.
That's but, for him. That's pretty heavy, though, isn't it?
But yeah, it is. And I thought that, like, when fight week came and he cut the weight, he had a pretty easy weight cut. I think he dropped like 10 pounds of water. I want to say he got in the ring probably around 195. But like, you could see, he was definitely bigger than he was. But it was like solid weight. It wasn't like somebody blew up and you know.
Like
it was,
when BJ like, Penn fought Machida or something like that, it was all sloppy.
Right.
So is Nick gonna compete again, or what is his thoughts after this fight?
I've probably said it four times on the show, Joe. I'll say it again. I really have no fucking idea what's going on in his head. I hope he does. I think we, you know, there was some stuff that one of the problems that we had in the fight was it was the first time I had ever cornered Nick. And when I was yelling stuff at him, he didn't recognize my voice.
Really?
So a lot of the stuff I was saying, he told me after, he was like, oh, that was you? And I was like, yeah, who the fuck? I wasn't screaming fucking Portuguese. And he was like, fuck, I didn't know if that was, you know. And
that's fun.
Yeah, I think we could do even better. And I think I think he did great. I think he has some really exciting matchups for him. I'd like to see him rematch Carlos Condon. I think that'd be a huge fight.
That would be a great fight.
I'd love to watch. I'd like to see him rematch you know, Robbie Lawler would be huge, you know, maybe beats Carlos and then that gives him a title shot. Maybe Dana gives him a title shot. I don't really know. I'm just guessing.
I love those two fights. I think
GSP
that would be fantastic.
GSP comes back after a 2-year layoff or whatever it is. If he does decide to come back, I think that's another awesome fight. You know, Nick says he wants the big fights. He's obviously a marquee fighter. I think that there's a lot of really exciting matchups for him.
Well, I think this fight only raised his profile.
I think so too.
I think he did a fantastic job against the greatest of all time. I mean, it's him and Fedor. Those are the two arguments of who's the greatest of all time. It's right. Anderson and Fedor. And, you know, it's one of those, there's no right answer, you know?
Right.
Fedor had some amazing fights in Pride, and then, but the problem is, those guys that he fought, they came over from Pride and they fought in the UFC, they didn't look nearly as good. So what is that? Is that because Fedor beat them up? Is it because they're not on steroids anymore? Is it because they weren't that good in the first place? Is it their shop worn?
Is it the cage?
Right. Yeah. So there's all these different questions. But those are the two guys that, in my opinion, I go with Anderson because mostly because I've seen him live, and I think that the level of competition that he faced is probably a little higher. But it's an argument that I could see. Like when people say Fedor was the greatest of all time, I'm like, yeah, I could see your argument. You know, I mean, I'm not 100% against it. But to go five rounds like Nick did, being a guy who fought his original career at 155.
Unbelievable.
Amazing. I mean, he fought fucking Diego Sanchez at 155. Mm-hmm. You know, he fought a lot. Sean Sherk, 155. Mm-hmm. And fights Anderson, 30 pounds heavier, and it's very competitive.
That was his sixth or seventh fight where his opponent was either at one time a UFC champion or went on to become a UFC champion. He fought six or seven of those guys in his career.
That's amazing.
That's amazing, right?
Push, and like when push I was, that thing up to your face so people hear you better.
Sorry. And then when I was going through his I was looking at the opponents and the strikers that Anderson had fought in his career, and then I was looking at the strikers and the opponents that Nick had fought in his career, and it was just for my own curiosity. But like Nick fought straight with his hitters and at their best, you know? Like
oh, yeah. When, Paul Daly.
Paul Daly, when Robbie Lawler was a monster, you know, at his best, when or now he's got a new best, I'm not sure, but
I think he's at his best now.
Yeah,
but,
and then Chris Lytle, you know, a lot of like really really good strikers when they were, you know, the Japanese guy when he fought him in Pride,
Gomi,
you
yeah.
know, geez, Gomi was knocking the shit out of everybody.
Yeah,
know? So Nick has always taken those really tough fights. And whether people love him or hate him, no one can ever say that Nick doesn't fought his way to get where he is. You know,
no doubt.
That's really impressive.
No, he's a very good, very good fighter. It's just one of those things where I just feel like right now is a great time for him. If he wants to like follow through right now, if he really wants to remain active and jump right back in there, there's so many marquee battles for him. I would love to see Nick versus Hector Lombard. You want to talk about, I mean, what the fuck would happen to Hector Lombard if Nick starts talking shit to him like that, you
right.
know? And
it's a good fight, too.
Great fight. Hector's a monster.
You know, and Matt Brown would be an awesome
fuck
fight, too.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of really exciting fights for him at 170, and I'm sure there are some at 185 as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, if he's wants to, there's some good fights for Nick. You know, now that watching him against Anderson Silva, there's not really a weight class I wouldn't want to see him fight at. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I suppose heavyweight. But like,
no higher than 185.
I think he could fight
yeah.
all those guys.
Yeah, I know? Think he could go back and forth between 70 and 185 if he wanted to.
And it's funny that, you know, people are watching that fight and they're like, oh, Anderson's, you know, that would let's see Anderson retire. He's not the same person anymore. Nobody's saying that about Nick, and that's after a 2-year layoff.
It's true.
Which is really impressive.
Well, people are concerned about Anderson. First of all, that, you know, after the fight was over, to watch him like weeping like that is also one of the reasons why people are concerned.
Right.
You know, they're like, Jesus Christ, like this is like the pressure on this guy must have been tremendous.
Right. I mean,
he's 39 years old.
I've come back from knee surgeries before, and like that must have been such a really, really challenging thing to come back from all that. And you know, you know, maybe he wasn't crying because he was, you know, I don't know why he was crying, but I'm sure that was a lot emotional to go through, you know, and to come back after being knocked out and, you know, basically humiliated, and then your next fight again, you get your legs shattered and you're out for another year, you know.
Yeah.
It's a lot of pressure on somebody, and maybe those are just tears of joy. He was happy to, or pride or whatever it was, you know.
Right. Well, the second fight, what disturbed me wasn't even the leg snap. I mean, the leg snap was disturbing, but I'd seen that before. What disturbed me was how easy he went down in a clinch. He got clinched up and Weidman hit him with the right hand, and yep. his body just gave out. I was like, I don't like that, because if you go back and you watch Anderson's younger days, he took a fucking tremendous punch. You go back, watch him versus, was it Jorge Oliveira? Yeah. And he gets cracked with Jorge Rivera. It was Jorge Rivera, not Oliveira. George Rivera. Yeah, Jorge, right? He called whatever he calls it. It was a big puncher. He's a big puncher. And Anderson, like, stood in front of him and let him tee off on him. It was weird. And then he was, like, smiling at him and then fucked him up afterwards. You know, the Lee Murray fight. He got tagged by Lee Murray. And Lee Murray's a fucking murderous puncher. Fine. No, you know, no problems at all. It's just one of those things where when it goes, it goes.
Yeah. That's true. And that was something else that we were looking at, like, in the camp, you know, we were looking at, you know, we were obviously concerned how Nick was going to react in the clinch with Anderson after seeing Anderson's fight with Rich Franklin, you know, and then watching the fight over again with Weidman, I was like, I want you to punch from there, just start throwing punches and cross face to get out of that clinch. And you see how easily Nick was able to, you know, get out of it and how well it worked for Weidman. And it was like with Rich Franklin, he had really no idea what to do there, you know, so.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah, Rich was at a loss when it came to that. He's, you know, he's a very tough guy and a very well-conditioned guy, but I don't think he was the most technical when it came to certain aspects of fighting. But he was at he came up in a different era, you know?
And that was my goal when it came to, like, bringing in the sparring partners and putting him in those situations. Rich Franklin obviously is capable of doing a lot of different things in that clinch. He just had never been in that situation. His training partners didn't expect it or whatnot, hadn't prepared him for that. So,
and once Anderson hits you with a few of those knees, you're kind of fucked.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then, if, you know, what you're going to do makes, if no one's ever taught you anything other, it's like, oh, shit, don't need me there again. And then bang, it hits your face. So.
Yeah, he didn't know how to control the hips. He didn't know what to do. And just, you know, that was he was new school. He was like the new era in like 2003. Mm-hmm. That's what Franklin was. He was like the new era of athletes, supremely conditioned. I remember they used to show on those countdown shows, they'd show his training, you know, his workout routine. It was brutal.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody worked out back then as hard as Rich Franklin did.
And he was huge for 185.
Giant.
Remember his, like, what was that Hawaiian league he used to fight in before UFC? It was like a super brawl or whatever. He was like 225 champion. Like, he was a heavyweight.
He was a big guy.
Big guy.
He was really thick. And when he went down to 185, I mean, he was it was a struggle. Yeah. The first few fights at 185 before he figured out how to dial it in perfectly, it was a struggle. Mm-hmm. That's the weird thing about what we were talking about before, the weight cutting. Like, when's too much? What's not enough?
Yeah.
You know, and then he was the guy to retire Chuck Liddell at 205. So it's, you know, nobody saw that coming. Right. If you ever thought that Rich Franklin was going to knock Chuck Liddell dead, you know, who thought that was going
to
happen?
And what a weird fluke shot. Not a fluke. I mean, obviously, he may have probably meant to do it. But the way that Chuck went down, it wasn't like, you've seen Chuck get hit with way harder shots than that.
That was just
a sign, you know, like once it's gone, it's gone.
He got tagged earlier in the round too, that I think contributed to that. Yeah. He got hit with some big shots earlier in the round where you could see, like, he got dinged, you know, and Dana and I actually talked about it before, and he said he felt like Chuck was hurt early in the round, and, you know, that was just the one that just put him away, was the one that landed. It was crazy that Rich was, he hit him with a broken arm, you know, he hit him with the right hand, and then after the right hand, he hit him with his left, and his left had been snapped earlier in the fight. He didn't even, you know, just threw punches and didn't even realize it. And after the fight, he realized, oh, shit, what the fuck's going on with this thing? That's a common thing in kickboxing, though, isn't it? Like blocking those kicks on the forearm.
Yeah, taking kicks on the arm. There's a way you can do it, though. Like, a lot of people, and I was another thing I was explaining to Nick in this camp, is somebody along the line told Nick to block, like, your holding pads this way. So that's, like, exposes your camera. this like exposes your forearm, like the bone on bone. If you keep this inside, you're going to take it on like the meat of the arm, the meat of your other arm, and then you put one hand here. So this doesn't hurt nearly as bad as going here. There it's bone on bone, and the shin's going to win against the ulna or whatever bone that is every time.
It's so weird when you watch a guy's shit get broken, like the Tyrone Spong Gokhan Saki fight, especially when a guy like Spong is just like such a high level kickboxer. You watch him throw a kick and then you see his leg just go noodle, just snap.
So awful. And then I think Jerome LeBanner had broke Saki's arm back in K1 once in the past too. So.
Well, remember when Gokhan Saki fought against Alistair Overeem in the finals? His his arm was shot.
Yeah, it that's what it was.
He got hit and his arm was fucked up before, you know, that fight even started.
And he threw like one more kick and he's like,
yeah, he was done.
And his arm's done.
Yeah. The bones, there's just nothing that makes them any tougher than, you know, you're born with a certain amount of bone density and you can lift weights and they'll get thicker and a little bit stronger, but...
So someone was telling me that because usually all of the guys that I can remember that I've seen where they're breaking their legs were always black guys. You notice this?
Wow.
And somebody was telling me that, I think you can Google it, that there is a... there was actually a study done by it that... vitamin D, I think it's D3, like something that we get from the sun. The darker skinned people have like a almost like a filter of it, and they don't absorb as much as it. And but it was like Corey Hill, Tyrone Spong, Anderson Silva, Danny Beal back in the day. Like almost every person I can think of that had their legs snapped in kickboxing was a black guy.
I've definitely seen white guys online.
Yeah,
get their legs snapped in kickboxing. I'm sure white dudes are just as vulnerable. I think it's just a luck thing.
Somebody told me that, and I Googled it, and sure enough, there was like a study done on it that it works like your darker skin tone works as like a filter, and you don't absorb as much. I think it was D3.
That's weird because I guess, you know, the more melanin acts as like sunscreen.
Yeah, maybe it was melanin, something like that.
That's interesting. I don't know about all that.
I couldn't believe it. Joe Rogan's like, Joe Schilling is the most gullible. He just throws out facts. And
that's what everybody does on this show, though. I do it all the time, too. But I think that, like...
But I did Google that one. That one is true.
But African Americans tend to have thicker bone density.
See, I think it was the exact opposite, is what that said.
That's not true. Bone density. They definitely have more bone density because, in fact, African American women tend to have a similar bone density as European males.
Really?
Yeah. Africans have thicker bone density. African in general, but you got to realize that varies with strength training. Like when they do that with people, a lot of times you're not testing people that are lifting weights. When you lift weights, your bone density increases dramatically, especially with people who do like power lifting. You know, like their fucking jaws get wider. You know, their head gets thicker. It's because your whole body is dealing with. There's a little bit of that going on too.
Power lifters get a little bigger.
But even if you're natural, just carrying. That, you know, just lifting very heavy things forces your body to go, oh, this motherfucker, what are we doing with our body here? Mm-hmm. You know, your body's pretty adaptable, man.
Yeah.
I mean, look at people that are yogis that can get in all these crazy positions, and they're not born that way. Yeah. They're just slowly stretching themselves into that position. You know, and that's the flexibility of your muscles. It's the density of your bones. The body will adapt to stress. Mm-hmm. The more you give it, the more it sort of tries to conform to this new work that you're asking it to do.
Right, and then like kicking pads and like kickboxing for sure. Our bones get thicker. Like the micro whatever.
Well, they also say when you're kicking like shin on shin all the time, what you're also doing is you get these deposits of blood, and it fills up and calcifies, and you know all the bruises when it heals, those micro fractures and tiny, you're getting all this calcification. It almost leads to like a shin instep protector,
right?
You know, all over your shin. Like, you ever see that fight in Lion Fight where Malapet just starts, he kicks this guy and you see the guy react. Mm-hmm. And so he just starts going shin to shin with him, just winging his shins. And I'm laughing at the guy because Malapet's shins have just been numb since he was like six.
Yeah. I mean, he's got over like 400 fights, I think.
Yeah. Ridiculous.
It's nuts.
But it's almost like he's got armor on his shins. Mm-hmm. And he's just smashing them into the other guy's shins and laughing at him while he's doing that. Because his shins all just fucking covered this layer of protection that's been built up. Mm-hmm. like Knuckles, like those dudes, those karate Makiwara guys.
Right, right. I had a guy like that in my gym. Yamato.
Does that fuck your hands up, though? Because I would think that, like...
I would think so. I mean, I used to tell them all the time, like, bro, we wear gloves and wrap your hands. What the fuck is the point of that shit? Like, kick that thing if you're going to do it. Like, what the fuck are you doing? You know? But he was, like, on some, like, samurai type shit.
Well,
his knuckles would just be, you know, like, just crazy calcified. I mean, I have pretty big knuckles now, too, but... Yeah, I would think that, like, your hand would not work properly. You're going to have arthritis and shit.
That's what I'm worried about, the arthritis. My friend John, he used to do that shit. He used to break bricks and those karate demonstrations and shit. But he would always practice, like, hitting the Makiwara. And his, Makiwara is just like this, for folks who don't understand, it's like a 2x4 that's wrapped with rope. And they, you know, lock it into the ground so it's real stiff. And they would pound this 2x4 with a rope until you develop all this calcification and all this calluses all over the top of your knuckle, where it's like one big knuckle. The first two knuckles become one big giant knuckle. Mm-hmm. But does that help your hands?
I don't
protect you from getting injured.
I don't.
It seems like it would.
I think most of the time the injuries that happen in boxing or in fighting is usually these bones.
The small ones towards the pinky, you know? And the next finger, right?
Yeah.
They're not protected as much, right? Yeah.
Well, like, this is actually, if you break this and you go to the doctor, they're going to call it a boxer's fracture. It's that common that it's... I broke mine when I was a kid. But these are usually the bones that break. But usually they say, like, you want to hit with these two bones because these two bones line up directly with your wrist.
And right.
These two are, like, kind of on an angle, so it's a lot easier to break these.
Yeah. Two. Yeah. Yeah, especially considering, like, how your hand's built. Like, some people, they have a more narrow hand. Maybe it would be more protected by the outside edge, but mine sticks out on the side. Yeah, it's like a weird thing, man. The hand's just not designed to punch people.
Speaking of which, like, Nick's is gnarly. Nick has, like, this crazy knot right here on his... I just saw it the other day, and it was on both wrists. I'm like, what the fuck is that?
Probably broke it and never did anything about it.
Yeah, you know? Just nut.
Probably broke it. Just let it heal on its own.
It's like this crazy lifted up thing, like right here in the center of his hands, on both of his hands.
That's probably not good. That guy's got some scar tissue, man.
He's got some scar tissue.
He's been through some fucking wars. But look at you, man, looking beautiful. 31 years of age. Look, I mean, if people didn't know you, they would never think you're a professional kickboxer.
It's true. I've had a few cuts and scratches. I've got both sides of my eyes. I've had cut under both eyes. Never broke my nose. Although Simon Marcus and I think our first fight, he had slammed me, like tripped me, and like landed on top of me and knocked me. I was out of it. And stand up and I'm walking the wrong direction. And the ref wasn't paying attention and said fight. And I just got blasted like two more times. But after that fight, like one of the things he finished me with was like a push kick to the face. And after that fight, like all of the cartilage inside my nose, like this ball or whatever, doesn't sit right anymore. It's like a little crooked because of this. And I can't fix it.
Does it breathe? Can you breathe out of your nose?
Yeah, I can breathe out of both though.
That's good.
But it's like if I stick my finger in this part, there's space. And like this one, there's like a ball in there where he just kind of rearranged my cartilage. Gave me a nose job. It's okay. I knocked him out. We're even.
Well, the last fight is the fight that's the most important, right?
Right.
You know, if you'd knocked him out the first time, then he beat you a few times. Right. You wouldn't feel so even.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We were talking about taking punches. I'd hate to put him on blaster. Now he, after I was the first person to knock him out, he was 39-0, or some super impressive record. You know, it was awesome. But he just fought in China, I think, a week or two ago, and he got dropped like 3 or 4 times and finished. Like he couldn't take a punch anymore. Like,
really,
it really affected his
ability
to take a
punch. Who knocked him out?
Some Chinese guy. I don't remember his name.
No shit.
Yeah, say, look up Simon Marcus.
That's really China. Incredible when you think about the fact that he did have that amazing record coming into that fight with you.
Mm-hmm.
That fucking right hand that you landed on him was so perfect.
Yeah.
It was so perfect to watch him fucking just drop like he got shot by a sniper.
You know,
in front of all the people in L.A.?
You know what's...
I got to tell you that before that. That Can't Stop Crazy is fun until you have someone fucking yelling it over and over behind your ear while you're trying to watch the fights. I was watching the fights and some chick was yelling, "Can't Stop Crazy! Can't Stop Crazy!" Like, fucking relax, honey. Okay? We heard it the first 30 times. She literally kept yelling it while you were fighting.
Really?
Can't Stop Crazy. I don't know. Was she trying to get on camera?
Yeah, I don't know.
Or what?
That's awesome, though.
It was quite obnoxious.
I mean, it was obnoxious, but...
But awesome that you have that kind of support.
Yeah, it's awesome to have that kind of support.
But, dude, when he went down, that place was deafening. because it's in your hometown, yeah, in L.A. That was some wild shit.
It was such an incredible. I mean, I used to, you know, before Glory came along, I was fighting. I mean, I had some pretty big, Lion Fight had some big shows when at the Hard Rock. But for the most part, it was like Hollywood Park Casino, you know, 1,200 people.
Right.
And to be at the Forum and like walking out. Usually I walk out and I'm like tunnel vision. I don't see the fans. I'm just focused on what I'm going to do. And like when I walked out for that, like the ovation from all the fans was like, it kind of choked me up a little bit. I had to like take a breath and like blow kisses to the fans. Like, I had to do something to show my appreciation. It was really overwhelming.
That was an cool, awesome environment, man. The cool Forum was so packed and it was so intense. And it was, everybody was also recognizing that this was a big moment for kickboxing. Yeah. It's like kickboxing, you know, I've been to a bunch of smokers and I've been to some pro matches in LA and around the area. It was always, they were small. It wasn't that, you know, well received. It wasn't that big of a deal, but man, this was a giant deal. Mm-hmm. All the Spike TV cameras, you know, everybody, people being interviewed and the whole deal. It was like, there was so much energy behind it that mm-hmm. like everybody was realizing, wow, this might, and the fact that it was a big pay-per-view card.
Right.
Like this might be a big moment where kickboxing becomes just like MMA, you mm-hmm. know, becomes like this next level sport. Because I'd always said, like, when you look at the level of competition, like when MMA became huge, the level of competition was not nearly as high as where the level of kickboxing competition is right now. The level is very high.
Right.
Like the Nicky Holtzkins and right. the, you know, the guys that are at the very top of the list, there's this level that's like a real solid world championship, world class level, mm-hmm. where the MMA wasn't really there in 2005 when it emerged.
Right.
It's like all the pieces are in place. Yeah. Well, that's like more
like super
so
tough guys. Yeah, yeah. They weren't the skill set.
Yeah, but we'll go back to Rich Franklin. I mean, Rich Franklin's a very good fighter, but like the difference between like Rich Franklin of, you know, the Rich Franklin that fought Anderson Silva and say like you know, like one of the, like Mighty Mouse Johnson,
right,
who's in my opinion like the most technically sound fighter. Mm-hmm. Like that motherfucker is world class at everything he does. Everything he does right. is perfect.
Yeah.
You've got that. You know, like with Mark Dubont, you got that with you. You got that with, you know, the elite kickboxers of today. Whereas I don't think MMA had that when it started to take off. So like if the promotion was behind it, and if they just if it caught on with the American people and the names started getting established, you know, Joe Schilling and all these guys, and you know, these names became more established, and it became something that became, you know, mainstream. I just think like the quality is there. The product is there. It's all just a matter of promoting it and mm-hmm. getting people to. That's the other thing that Dana said when I was trying to get them to buy it, like way back in the day. They're like, you know what, Americans were so poisoned by like PKA karate.
Right.
You know, that they just have this idea in their head that's just like, it's just dog shit.
Right.
You know, like when guys would throw like a bunch of flippy kicks just to get the kicks yeah. in, and then when, you know, you have to throw like five
throw
kicks around
kicks
or whatever
turns
it was
into boxing after that.
Yeah, it was like, it was a weird time. It just wasn't the same. It's like the level just wasn't the same. It's not like what you see today. Mm-hmm. You know, like what you see today, when you see they're throwing kicks because the kicks are effective. Like
right.
like Raymond Daniels. I mean, that guy's throwing some wild, crazy shit, you yeah. know? Daniel Guida. He's throwing some fucking powerful fucking kicks.
That's what's really exciting about the kickboxing. Like, if we were talking the other day about there's the heavyweight division in MMA right now is it's lacking compared yeah. to the other divisions, right? When you look at kickboxing heavyweights, you got guys like Daniel Guida, who's like 6'5", like 245 pounds, throwing head kicks and has the punch speed of like a middleweight, you know, and Rico Verhoeven. Like the heavyweights in kickboxing, you got guys that are like 6'5", and they're still throwing head kicks. They don't move like Tim Sylvia. They don't move
right.
like these MMA guys are used to seeing. And it's just really, really exciting stuff. Like Rico Verhoeven is incredibly athletic. He's a sparring partner with I forget his name. Really high level boxers in Europe. And then Ariel Zimmerman is just a knockout artist from the K-1 days. He fought all the top guys in K-1. It's just really, really exciting stuff.
And Rico Verhoeven is conditioning.
Yeah.
I mean, for a heavyweight, he's a lot like Kane in that sense, too, where that mm-hmm. guy just does not get tired. I mean, he will go five 3-minute mm-hmm. rounds and be 100% through the yep. – and that's where he beat Daniel Guida, I think.
Right.
He started wearing him down, and then the conditioning sort of took in. I mean, he can fight at a very high level for a long time. Mm-hmm. And he's a young guy too. He's got a
yeah,
bright future.
Young kid.
I mean, how old is Rico?
I don't know. I think he's 20. I'd say 26 at most.
Yeah. That's, what's it say here?
And he's a huge guy. I mean, when you're next to him, like, he's huge hands. Like, he's just a giant, giant man.
Yeah, I just hope it takes off, man. I really do, because I think I do enjoy boxing. I'm a big boxing fan, but I like kickboxing a lot more. Like, I will watch kickboxing fights over and over again. I will rewatch them. Where I think the more elements you add to fighting, the more interesting it becomes. I actually kind of wish it was Muay Thai. You know,
right,
I think
I
that the clinching is an important aspect of it. The tying up and the knees to the body and, mm-hmm. and the dumps. I think those that's an important part of the art. And also the elbows and knees and the clinch. I mean, mm-hmm. I think they're very important. I love a lion fight. Right. You know, and Kevin Ross is your guy, right?
Yeah,
you trained
Kevin
with
Ross
him
is one of my best friends. Yeah,
I love that guy. I love watching him fight too. He's a pure Muay Thai. Like, you watch him fight the way he controls distance, the distance between the throw and the kicks and the punches, and he's doing everything the right way. Where he's like the right technique for the right distance. It's all like it's a beautiful thing to mm-hmm. watch. You get to see the true art of Muay Thai represented when he's fighting. You know,
absolutely, absolutely.
I think that's missing in a little bit in Glory. I'm like, I wish they would go with the elbows and the knees and letting guys tie up in the clinch and throw knees to the body.
I think their thought process with the clinch is that it turns into like a way of stalling or a way of like, you can't punch with them. You're not as good at punching. You're not as good at kicking. So you just clinch them up and then, you know, it ends up being like a wrestling match. You know?
But
I think
does
that's
it?
What they're saying.
I mean, think they're silly. I think
my two fights with Simon Marcus absolutely did.
Well, Simon Marcus, that is his style,
yeah.
Right? That was one of the reasons why he beat so many guys. His clinch was phenomenal.
Phenomenal.
And he was so physically strong.
Right.
You know, how much of a difference did you feel fighting him in a Muay Thai fight and fighting him in Glory?
I didn't really notice that much of a difference, to be honest with you.
I felt like
I was in a lot better shape and and a lot more prepared for the last man standing thing. But I think it also forced him. He had to, you know, he wasn't able to hold on the way he wanted to and to do what he wanted to do. So I think it's unfair for me to say it if it was, I don't know. That was a really good fight. I enjoyed the fight.
It's a great fight for you. Fuck
but
yeah.
I really liked, you know, I always thought that, Glory rules with elbows would be really interesting. Like, even if you didn't allow the clinch, but you allowed elbows, because elbows are actually my favorite weapon. That's how I got my ring name. Most of my first 10 knockouts were by elbow or from like knee to the head from the clinch.
Yeah, I think it's a great technique.
I think it's a very great technique. I don't know why they don't do it, honestly. I think K1, they didn't do it because Japan isn't like big on the blood thing. You
mm-hmm.
know? So maybe that was why they used to stop fights and wipe the blood off and all that stuff. But, I really love elbows. Like, if you look at guys like Nathan Carnage,
mm-hmm. Corbett. Sure, yeah.
He was like the elbow god with like beautiful boxing ability and then sneaking in the elbows. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a big fan of the elbow.
Yeah, and I think that those guys, when they're fighting in kickboxing as opposed to Muay Thai, there's like an element of their game that they've worked so hard to adapt and to get proficient at, and then that element's been removed. You're forcing them to fight at like 70%.
Exactly.
Yeah, and
that's something that happened with Simon, you know, in that fight with me. I mean, that was his first fight. His first loss was his first kickboxing fight. You know,
mm-hmm.
First knockout loss was his first kickboxing fight. And then this one that just happened was also, I think, kickboxing or San Shao rules or whatnot.
Yeah. Oh, it was San Shao rules?
I think Wenlong Fong.
So San Shao, were you allowed to throw takedowns and stuff too?
Yeah,
is that
I don't really know about. I mean, they call it, it seems like San Shao, but they call it something that Wenlong Fong. I did it once and it was horrible for me. It was actually when I tore my knee apart. But it was like you're allowed to judo throw or like. But somehow they were yelling at Simon when he was trying to clinch. I didn't really understand it.
What do you think about what John Wayne Parr is doing, that cage combat thing? He's got like he's like got Muay Thai, but they're fighting in a cage with like MMA gloves.
I particularly don't care for it. I mean, I don't like. I think it's. I just see it as a gimmick over trying to tap into the MMA scene. I mean, we just talked about the cage makes it really hard to see.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that you can clinch as well against the cage as you can in the ropes because you can move them backward.
There's
more positions from
right.
That. And I think it's more about like just attaching the gimmick or making it more brutal than, you know, thing than it is. And I think a lot of guys are breaking their hands.
With the little gloves?
With those little gloves doing it. You know, I wouldn't want to do it.
Defensively, it's a big issue, right, with the little gloves where you can slip punches through where you can't.
You know, I thought it was going to be, and then when I started training for the Melvin fight, I didn't find that much difference.
No?
It, Although, I think if I had, if Melvin had a boxing glove on, it hit me on top of the head there, it might not have put my legs out, and I might not have dropped as easily as I did. I don't know if Melvin would have went down from that right hook with a boxing glove as dramatically as he did.
Did Glory adopt K1 rules just because K1 was like the big organization and K1 started to fall off, and then It's Showtime came along and It's Showtime put up some really big fights, and then Glory kind of came along and took that over?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what happened. I think that from what I understand, the guys, K1 was K1, and then most of the fighters from Holland were under one management team. And when K1 started to fail, that management team had all the contracts for the K1 guys, and they started It's Showtime because they already had all the fighters under contract. And then when It's Showtime eventually sold to Glory, the company Glory, and then it was just like the same people, same scenario.
I think, right.
It just grew from that, and then now it's
So Lion Fight is the only like really big Muay Thai promotion, national on television, national Muay Thai promotion in this country.
I think Legacy Fighting just made a deal. Is on TV. They're on the Access as well.
Oh, they're Access too.
Access too.
Interesting.
Yeah,
Access is fucking great, man. Which used to be HDNet. It's like one of the best accesses best ways to access like up and coming fighters, mm-hmm. like the smaller organizations.
Right. Yeah, I don't get that channel. I remember when HDNet was on there. Then they had the MMA. What MMA shows were there on? Was it WEC was on HDNet?
No, it was up in Canada. What the fuck is his name? Oh, God damn it. I can't remember. In Edmonton. You know what I'm talking about, that dude.
But and you remember Spike TV when the UFC was still on it and had the Ultimate Fighter? That was like kind of the home for combat sports. And I know that Spike TV is now... rebranding, I think, in March, and they just signed
Spike TV's rebranding,
something like
that. Changing the name?
No, I don't know about rebranding. They're changing their revitalizing their look or something. I don't know. They're trying to get back to being the home for combat sports. I know they just signed a deal with Floyd Mayweather's manager. They made boxing. They're gonna have boxing on Spike TV now too.
So. Oh yeah, they're having like Golden Glory, right? Not Golden Glory. Golden Boy. Golden Boy Productions is going to be on Spike TV.
Well, I think I don't know if it's Golden Boy. It's I'm Floyd Mayweather's coach. I forget what they're going to call it. It's Al Heyman is promoting it, and so now they're going to have boxing, kickboxing, and Bellator MMA on Spike, which is really
that's beautiful.
It's gonna be really good for because that's their demographic. Was all kind of geared around the Ultimate Fighter, and all their shows were like the same. I think from my perspective, so.
I think it's great. I think that, the more the better. I just think they should change the name Bellator.
Yeah,
it's fucking goofy. It's a goofy name.
What do you think better?
What does it mean? The fuck is a Bellator? How do you even spell it? Is it one L?
I don't know. I always spell it wrong. When I hashtag it, I spell it wrong almost every time.
I love the fights. I love the organization, but they should call it just Spike TV MMA. It's mixed martial arts. Everybody knows what it is.
It's true.
Just why, like when you watch boxing, it's not, Thunder Fist Boxing.
Right.
The name is... The UFC, like when it comes to MMA, UFC is like NFL, right? It's got that, it's like Q-tips and Kleenex,
right.
You don't ask for a tissue, give me Kleenex, give me a Q-tip. You don't ask, may I have a cotton swab,
right.
It's like they become names, like I'll have a Coke.
Like Velcro.
Yeah, it becomes like, I think Velcro is actually a patent, isn't it? I don't know. But
no,
exactly.
It's not. When my father-in-law's in the army and they don't call it Velcro, it's called something else.
Hook and loop.
Yeah, hook and loop or something, because Velcro is a brand.
Yeah. Right. So it is the same thing.
Right.
Yeah. But that said, MMA is what it is. Everybody knows it's mixed martial arts, mm-hmm. And I think that if they just went with MMA, just have MMA on Spike TV. Have the name of the fighters be the what's important.
Hmm.
I think Bellator, the name itself is kind of goofy. And the fucking helmet. Like, why is there a Roman guy with a helmet?
Yeah, or did that come about around the 300 thing? Because it seems very 300-esque.
It is kind of.
It's kind of.
I think it's a Roman thing, the name, but whatever. Maximum Fighting Championship was what I was trying to remember.
Right.
MFC, Mark Pavlich's organization, which is up in Edmonton, which is another good thing to watch. Where like you see a lot of like Ryan Jimmo came out of there. A lot of young up and coming guys that are really good fighters came out of these HG Net fights that they used to put on back in the day. So if Spike can do that and just make it like the home for fighting, like every Friday night boxing, right. MMA, kickboxing, people will get programmed. If they just stick with Glory, I feel like it can't miss.
Yeah,
it's just a matter of promoting it correctly, getting right. people to understand like these are the best kickboxers on earth, and it's super high level shit. Mm-hmm. It's not like, you know, they're just learning how to kickbox or putting them on TV. Like, these are the best of the best.
Do you think there needs to be more Americans fighting for American audience to, because I hear that a lot, and I don't know. I mean, are we that?
Yeah.
Are we that?
Some
way?
People.
I don't know if we are that way or not.
Some people curious. Are.
Yeah.
There's like, a lot of us.
Like, I don't want to watch this Turkish guy because he's Turkish. I
just
want
to lie.
See American.
Put yeah. a fucking American flag on a short. Yeah. Send him out there. Don't let him talk.
Don't let him talk.
No, don't do that. You'll get caught. Well, listen, man, I know you must have to pee. You've been holding on to that water.
I do.
I know you do. And this weekend, this Friday night, folks can watch it. It's going to be live on Spike TV. It's Glory 19. And where is it? It's from Virginia?
Yeah, Hampton, Virginia.
Hampton, Virginia.
The Hampton Coliseum, I think.
Is a huge event. If you've never watched kickboxing before, let this be your first one. And definitely cheer for my man, Joe Schilling, who will be fighting in the co-main event of the evening. It's going to be a big card for Spike and a big card for Glory. And goddamn, I hope it's successful. So let's try to pump it up. Set your DVRs. Watch that shit. Joe Schilling, much love, my friend.
Thank you
very
much.
Thank you
so much, man.
Really appreciate it. I'm a huge fan. I'm fanboy geeking out right here, so this is great. You can follow Joe on Twitter. It's Joe Schilling 3 is his Twitter handle. How come 3? Who the fuck is 1 or 2?
If you find Joe Schilling 1 or 2, let me know, because I'm going to smack him around.
It
I don't know how
like
I got
should,
stuck with 3. I don't
it
know.
Seems like they should be able to take that over. Is there a guy that's Joe Schilling 1? Who's Joe Schilling? What's the look?
I don't know.
Oh, he's a basketball player for Duke. You dork. Oh, fuck. How dare you? He's only got 2 followers.
Come
on. What the
on.
Fuck? He's not even really a... God damn it, Joe Schilling. He's got 2 fucking followers. 2! 2!
It's terrible.
This is bullshit.
Bullshit.
Take it over.
I'm gonna
okay.
do it.
All right, my friend. Good luck to you. We'll
Thanks,
talk to
buddy.
You soon.
Appreciate it.